Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Going to talk about the Jack Lew confirmation hearing. Same as the old guy, pretty much. He's going to be replacing Timothy Geithner as Secretary of the Treasury. Hey, our Wall Street guys, you got a very small pool of people to choose from. Goldman Sachs, Citibank, the Wall Street big boys. You got to do your time on the street in order to get those kind of regulatory gigs so that you can go back when you've made your bones and you've done your favors with a little resume. Just a thought. We'll talk about that. Also, the U.S. Department of Labor is chastising the Corbett administration for its incompetence. Well, of course, regarding the unemployment compensation we got people calling us because they want stuff. It must be someone screwing with our system. It must be sabotage. Sabotage. No, Judith. It's incompetence. Anyway, minimum wage back on the agenda, or is it really? Is this just more nonsense? I'm hoping that we see a real increase in the minimum wage. One of the things I did like that the president said, tie it into inflation so that we don't have to keep doing this every couple of years and allowing it to be eroded away by inflationary forces. We should tie it to it so that everybody, and the reason that the right is so dead set against raising the minimum wage is because they know that as you raise the bottom wage, the floor, as you raise that floor, everybody goes up a little. And that not a good thing. Not a good thing, according to our friends on the radical right. Also, the time is ticking away on Saturday postal delivery, and the pollsters are crafting their questions to get the desirable results. As we've been seeing lately, poll after poll saying, people are okay with the question that we asked about ending Saturday delivery. Question is do they really know exactly what it means? Most people would say, I don't really know one way or another until it's gone. And as I've been saying, once it's gone, it's gone. There's no going back. And that's my problem with that. Also going to take your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Evidently, there was a shooting this afternoon or some instance of domestic violence over at the Hack campus in Harrisburg. Reports are that we've seen the male, or according to the website, the Hack website, the student is okay and the male is in custody. So hopefully everything is good there and classes can resume. But when I saw the report of it, I'm going, it was almost a year ago that there was a shooting right over there. A guy shot his wife, a guy from Missouri, shot his wife over it, and then held it was like a standoff for several hours while the woman was bleeding. And I go, it's just more gun stuff. You go, when are we going to start thinking about insanity? When are we going to start thinking about common sense when it comes to this stuff? I'm sure we're going to find out more. The big speech last night, if you missed the speech by the president, we're going to talk about it most of the night, but some things I liked, some things not so much, some things I really disliked. It was very centrist, very middle of the road. One could say that, the moderate Republican that Obama claimed he was, like 20 years ago or would have been 20 years ago, did come out in this. The left seems pretty happy with it. The right, he knew they would be inflamed by no matter what he said. In fact, one of the Republicans, this Paul Braun, the Republican representative from Georgia, got out and said, I was the first guy to call Obama a socialist. And I guess he's raising a ton of money off of it. One of these Tea Party guys, one of the ones who run around and say, redistribution of wealth. Obama wants to redistribute wealth. One of the things that I heard last night in the speech that I absolutely agreed with him on. Because one of the things I've been saying for the last couple of years is, look, we have had a recovery in this country. We've recovered from the Bush collapse. The problem is that you and me and working people like us, we didn't share in that recovery. That recovery was co-opted by the well-connected and the well-to-do. And in the speech, Obama pointed out that it is our generation's task. It's our generation's task to reignite the true engine of America's economic growth. He said a rising, thriving middle class. And he said that together, you know, we have cleared away the rubble of crisis, and we can say with renewed confidence that our state, that the state of our union is stronger. And I go, really? Because, you know, the next thing he said is corporate profits have skyrocketed to an all-time high. He said, but for more than a decade, wages and incomes have barely budged. Today, he said, a full-time worker making the minimum wage earns $14,500 a year. Even with the tax relief we've put in place, a family with two kids that earn the minimum wage still live below the poverty line, and that's wrong. I agree. Dead, absolute wrong. Which is why I wanted to hear something about collective bargaining, why I wanted to hear something about we're going to pass legislation to reform our broken labor laws so that minimum wage worker can say, you know what, I am making these big corporations, the big box retailers, the big fast food chains, making them millions. For instance, at McDonald's, the average worker is going to have to work 1 million hours this year to make what their CEO takes home. That, something wrong with. And I've been saying for the longest time that as corporate profits have gone through the roof, as they've never been higher, the tax rates for them never been lower, wages for you and me, stagnant and declining. We've known all this. We've been talking about this for a couple of years now. In fact, I pointed out the Emmanuel Saez and Thomas Piketty study done last year where they looked at the recovery up through 2010 and told you that 93% of all of the pre-tax new income, all of those gains in new income pre-tax went to the top 1%, 93% of all of it. Now, those are people who are making about $358,000 and up a year. 93% of the pre-tax, all of the pre-tax new income, all of it. Well, Saez has gone and updated that look. Now includes 2009, 2010, and 2011. And what did he find? Well, he found that not only did the top 1% capture the 2009, 2010, 93%, that 93% for that period had jumped to 121%. And you go, whoa, Rick, how did they get 121% of all of that? Because there can only be 100. This is the beauty of the system. They took 100% of all of the new gains plus more from you and me. And I have been saying for the longest time, at some point we're going to wake up to the reality that we're being robbed to fund the well-heeled. At some point, we're going to wake up to the reality that our wages not only have been stagnant for the last 30 years, but actually declining. So that extra 21% above and beyond the entire pie were the crumbs that were left behind from making the pie. It's what you would have gotten. It's the ingredients that you put in that you're never getting back because the wealth has been redistributed. You basically, you worked for free. And that is our capitalist system. And I know there's some, oh, we're a capitalist nation, Rick. Yeah, and these numbers point that out. They took 120%, 121% of all pre-tax income gains. Where are my Tea Party friends? Where are the cries and the hues and the screams? Where is the redistribution of wealth? Because I've been saying for the longest time, look, we need redistribution of wealth in the worst way. To redistribute it the way it was before we redistributed it. And Obama's right. We do need a strong and growing middle class. What has made this country great, what has made this country most prosperous and powerful is the fact that working people, average, everyday Joe Lunchbox and Ham and Eggers have had a shot. And at every turn, what we see is we see this assault on what built that middle class, what built that security, what built that ability to climb that socioeconomic ladder so that you had a shot to enjoy some of the better things in lives and enjoy maybe a little dignified retirement. And also invest in the future. What I find really most disturbing about this 121% number, is those wages that were taken away. Most of that is going to go towards investing in the future. The pay cuts and the benefit cuts and the pension cuts and all of these things that we see taken away every day. It's generally the future. Well, we're going to have to push off retirement a little longer. Well, we're going to have to push off the kids going to college. Well, we're going to have to push off, you know, preventative maintenance of our body, of our home, of our car, of whatever, or our infrastructure, whatever. All so that we can feed this very, very prosperous wealth class. It's fairly mind-blowing if you think about it. But it's what we've allowed to have happen. And why has it happened? Well, it's happened because and it's both parties. Because understand, it used to be up until President Obama that, you know, poor people did better under Democrats, rich people did better under Republicans. You know, I go back to my high school civics teacher who said, you know, at the end of the day, you know, you kids sitting in a middle-class classroom, you've got to decide. Because the Democrats tend to side with programs to help the poor, help the indigent, help, you know, those less fortunate. And the Republicans, their policies tend to help the very, very well-to-do who can afford to pay for the lobbyists and the politicians to push for it. All their loopholes and all their special interests. So you got to ask yourself the question. Being somewhere in the middle, where are you closer to? Are you closer to being homeless or closer to being Bill Gates or Warren Buffett's or one of the billionaires? Are you closer to being rich or poor? Because what we're seeing is before our eyes, systematically, the dismantling of all of those programs that stopped us from depression in 2008. Be it unemployment, be it food stamps, be it any government program that offers any elasticity to the economy. There's an all-out assault on it. And it's going to take us, united, to stand up and say no more. And you look at our governor and his administration, how they have badly screwed over unemployment compensation. The law that they passed last year, in my view, criminal. And now you look at this, you look at what's going on over at the Department of Labor and Industry, something seriously wrong. And when we come back, we're going to talk about what's going on over there and what the U.S. Department of Labor, the letter that they've sent. We're going to talk with our good friend, Attorney Erwin Aronson, when we come back. Quick break, right back after this.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Sister Simone Campbell is not a nun on the bus anymore, but she's still crisscrossing the country as director of NETWORK, advocating social and economic justice for workers and the poor.
Catholic social teaching is at the heart of it is about a sense of fairness, a sense of justice, that workers who work full-time should make enough to support their families. And actually, Catholic social teaching all got started with the idea that workers had a right to organize, that because we're made in the, as our faith teaches us, in the image of God and have inherent dignity, then we're called to use that dignity for the benefit of all. And that means coming together and making sure that working conditions are just and fair, that wages are just, that people don't struggle at the margins and be unable to care for their family.
Sister Simone is focused these days on helping to make sure Medicaid gets expanded to cover poor people as intended under the Affordable Care Act, and she also continues to push against austerity budget philosophies like Paul Ryan's House budget.
We continue to push back against the concepts that were contained in the House Ryan budget and the idea that cutting social safety net programs is the way forward for our nation. Clearly, reasonable revenue, raising our taxes is a key piece, and making all programs as responsible as social service programs, including the Pentagon, is a way forward.
The Michigan AFL-CIO, Change to Win, and the Building and Construction Trades Council of the AFL-CIO have sued the state of Michigan in an effort to have the recently passed anti-union legislation known as Right to Work thrown out. The suit seeks a permanent injunction declaring Right to Work illegal in Michigan. Among the grounds the suit cites for abolishing the law is that it violates the U.S. Constitution's Supremacy Clause because it violates the federal National Labor Relations Act protections on worker rights to organize and collectively bargain. The Michigan anti-union law is scheduled to take effect on or about March 27th. The lawsuit challenging the law was filed in federal court for the Eastern District of Michigan. In a new report, the Public Interest Research Group says states lose nearly $40 billion a year in tax revenue because corporations and wealthy individuals are using offshore tax havens to avoid paying their statutory tax rates. This offshoring of tax obligations also means the federal government loses roughly $150 billion a year in tax revenue. The Public Interest Research Group report says tax obligation offshoring hurts states and is unfair because it means that ultimately other taxpayers pick up the tab or have to suffer cuts in public services so the wealthy can avoid paying their statutory tax rates. This newscast is made possible in part through underwriting support from the IBEW and the OPEIU. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
I know many of you are going to be interested in this next subject. Pennsylvania sits within a day's drive of 60% of the nation's population. Every year, nearly $500 billion worth of goods and services move through our state transportation system. Transportation is the bloodstream of our economy. If it fails, our economy fails. However, as you know, the average bridge in our state is 51 years old.
Crumbling down, much like the sinkholes, 41 sinkholes in the last year in the Harrisburg area. And I'm still saying what we need to do is put together a sinkhole walking tour. Not just don't be too close. We should probably get a rope to space everyone out just in case someone falls in an open hole. We can then pull them out, have the rope available right there. But we need to highlight the fact that this governor, and look, past folks have not invested in infrastructure, have not invested in our roads and our bridges and in our state. And beyond that, in the nation. It just blows the mind. Anyway, welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Under the heading of, we don't believe in government, government's bad, and we'll show you that government's bad and that it doesn't work because we'll destroy it. I look at our Department of Labor and Industry, and you may remember we talked about this story where they said, we're getting millions of calls and we don't know what's going on. It must be sabotage. Sabotage is what it is. And then you find out, no, just plain incompetence. Then the U.S. Department of Labor steps in and says, we got some serious problems. Here to talk to us about the situation over at the Department of Labor and Industry with the Unemployment Insurance Program is our good friend, Attorney Erwin Aronson. Erwin, thanks for taking time for me.
Good to be here, Rick. How are you?
I am good. So I look at this story that, you know, first it's, you know, sabotage. You know, there are people who want to take down unemployed people or whatever their rationale was. Now we find out incompetent.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with you. I think it is sabotage. I think the Corbett administration is sabotaging the victims of this economy, people who are eligible for unemployment compensation benefits, who are entitled to unemployment insurance benefits, who have, while they are working, paid in unemployment insurance premiums, taxes, on every single penny of wages that they earn, even though their employers only pay on the first $8,000 a year that they earn. And this administration is not complying with minimum legal standards by failing to adequately handle claims, failing to timely handle claims, failing to make decisions in a required timely fashion, and creating this hodgepodge of delays by sabotaging the telephone system after they compel people to sign up by telephone, sabotaging the website after they compel people to have to sign up on the Internet, even though they can't afford to pay for the Internet access fees because they don't have jobs. And contrary to what you think, I candidly think it is sabotage, and I think it's sabotage under color of state law. It is an outrage. This is a system that has been put in place. And it candidly is a system that protects local businesses by assuring that people have a couple of dollars in their pocket to pay their basic bills, to keep body and soul together, keep a roof over their head, keep food on the table, maybe buy a pair of sneakers for the kids when they go to school. So I think it's sabotage, and I think the sabotage is happening right at the hands of the highest levels of this Corbett administration.
I guess when you lay it out like that way, I don't disagree. It's their ideology. Government just doesn't work, and they're going to put incompetent people. And so I guess it's just two ways of looking at the same ends.
Well, you know what? It's not that government doesn't work. It's that they have assumed their high offices, taken oaths of office to protect and defend and apply and enforce the laws of this Commonwealth, and then they go under color of law in their official capacities and make these programs of our government not work. They kill the programs and kill the people that are affected by them. We have seen this time and time again. They've destroyed our public education system by unfunding it and underfunding it and mashing programs. They have destroyed our access to funds that pay for senior citizens' property tax and rent rebates, pay for prescriptions for seniors, pay for transportation for seniors through the lottery, by purporting to privatize the lottery and smashing it in the process. They are trying to smash our wine and spirit store system that provides us with more than $500 million a year in income on top of 5,000 family-sustaining jobs with family-sustaining benefits. This is not an isolated occurrence. This is an ideological, intentional sabotage of government programs to make it appear as if government doesn't work, when we know that in 1935 and 1936, when the unemployment insurance system was created as a part of the federal Social Security law, and everything was done not with fancy computers and digital telephone lines and cyber applications, but with people with visors and garters on their sleeves working this out by doing everything by hand. The system somehow worked. And then the Corbettites took over, and they brought this system to a grinding halt with people who depend on their benefits to keep the telephone alive so they maybe can call somebody and see about getting a job, to keep a couple of gallons of gas in the car so they maybe can go to a job interview or fill out an application, are being delayed intentionally by not incompetence, by indeed sabotage. This is an outrage. And let me tell you how outrageous it is. There is a federal consent order applied by the federal courts to Pennsylvania that requires 80% of the cases to be resolved in 45 days. And one of the findings of the U.S. Department of Labor, it seems from this December letter that just became public in the last day or two, hidden from us by the Secretary of Labor and Industry, Julia Hathaway, and her minions, one of the most egregious assertions by the government of the United States of America, the U.S. Department of Labor, is that the claims are not being handled in a timely fashion consistent with that federal consent order that has been in place for decades. This isn't incompetence. This is intent. intentional action under color of state law, and this is an action that threatens to have the federal government deny well over $140 million of subsidy from the federal government to pay for the operation and administration of the unemployment insurance system. And I make mistakes sometimes because I've been at this too long, and I call it unemployment compensation, but it's not unemployment compensation. It's unemployment insurance. It's an insurance program that working people pay for directly out of their own paychecks and indirectly through lower wages, so that there will be benefits for them within the requirements of the law when they lose their job.
Right, through no fault of their own, of course.
Through no fault of their own.
And, you know, I look at this, and you pointed out that this adjudication process, which, for those who may not know, walk me through it.
Well, when one loses one's job in covered employment, employment that's covered by the unemployment compensation law, which is basically everything with the exception of some domestic work and some agriculture work, there's a waiting week. You don't get, and you're not eligible to get benefits for the first week that you're out of work. But you apply for benefits, and the local office is supposed to look at your wages in your base year, which is the first four of the last five completed calendar quarters, and then look at your high wages in the highest quarter of your base year, that first four of those last five calendar quarters, and determine both your benefit eligibility, which is based on having now, since January 1st, a minimum of 16 weeks of wages in your base year in which you earn $75 or more. And then there's a calculation based on what your annual wages were and your high quarter wages were. And many people are finding, since the latest so-called reform imposed on us by the corporate administration, by the corporate administration, that people who are high wage earners but work in areas like construction where some of the work is seasonal find that they've earned too much to qualify for benefits because they have a high amount of income in one quarter but low wages for the year. But once we get past that, then the unemployment insurance system at the local Career Link offices, which we used to call the unemployment offices, but they've changed that, are to do two calculations. One is a determination of a claimant's financial eligibility, whether one is eligible for benefits, and if so, how much. And then they're supposed to do a second determination as to whether or not one is actually eligible for benefits under the law. The law starts out with an assumption that every claimant who has worked in covered employment is eligible for benefits, assuming he or she has earned the minimum amount of wages and has an annual wage that comports with what their high quarterly wage is.
Right.
There are only way they can be disqualified for benefit eligibility is if they meet one of three broad-based disqualifiers in the law. One is a disqualification for quitting your job without a necessitous and compelling reason. In other words, you didn't like the job. A second is when one engages in a strike in which he or she is a direct beneficiary of the outcome of that strike, that work stoppage. And third is if somebody is terminated for willful misconduct, and willful misconduct is not defined in the unemployment compensation law, but it has been refined, if you will, by decades of judicial decisions that basically stands for the proposition that someone has been terminated from employment because he or she has engaged in conduct that's so inimical to the employer's interest that everybody would understand why this person would be terminated.
Right.
In every other situation, one is eligible for benefits. But if you are now running the system in Corbett land and you want to manipulate the system, you just take your good old time about making both the financial determination and the eligibility determination, and then people don't know if they're eligible for benefits, and this whole mess starts. And now Pennsylvania finds that it may very well be out of conformity with minimum federal standards because of the delays, because of this non-seasonable application of the law to victims of this economy, to victims of unemployment, to people and families who are counting on this modest supplement to keep body and soul together not being decided by the Department of Labor and Industry in conformity with the law, in conformity with the consent order that I referred to, in conformity with minimum federal requirements, in conformity with their own state regulations. And the federal government, the U.S. Department of Labor, has even asserted the Department of Labor and Industry here in Pennsylvania, under Secretary Hathaway and Governor Corbett, have failed to adequately develop, publish, and make available forms for filling out applications for unemployment insurance, for job applications, for participating in required work searches under the unemployment compensation law in this state. This is not a mistake. This is not incompetence. This is not even negligence.
Yeah, I mean, this
is
sounds
outrageous.
It is outrageous the way you've laid it out. And, you know, as you look at this, it sounds as if they're putting as many obstacles in the way so that you won't collect it and then you'll just move on.
Well, this is a sabotaging-based attempt to frustrate the unemployed people in Pennsylvania. And the real victims of this, right after the families of the unemployed in Pennsylvania, are the local pharmacies and the local grocery stores, the electric company, the gas company, the telephone company, the landlords who are counting on rental income, the banks that are counting on mortgage payments. Every one of these local businesses really depends upon these unemployment insurance benefits being available and available timely so that people can pay the bills and that people can feed their families. People can put clothes on their kids' back and, you know, pay for lunch money for the kids when they go to school. This is not a joke. This is not a mere ministerial act.
Well, what do you say to the argument that they make in this one article that I read that, well, it's because our phone system's outdated and the computer system, well, is aged. That's the reason. And, oh, by the way, they're blaming the federal funding cuts that nobody seems to see where the cuts came from.
Well, a spokesperson for the Secretary of Labor and Industry said this is all because the government of the United States of America cut $30 million from their subsidy. But that, of course, begs the question. We're hearing about that for the first time only after the government of the United States wrote a scathing letter to the secretary that was not made public, even though the letter was dated in December of 2012, was not made public until 6 weeks later here in February of 2013. And that $30 million, that alleged $30 million, can't have come as a news flash only after that letter showed up. But more importantly, the government of the United States says it simply didn't happen. And they've asked labor and industry to provide the statistics and the accounting for this, and they've determined that labor and industry can't do it, that it's a fraud. For all practical purposes, they didn't use the word fraud. That's my word, and it might be hyperbole, but it may not be hyperbole. I just don't know. We're not getting a whole lot of open government from this government that's supposed to be so open. On this topic, anyway.
Yeah, well, on a whole bunch of topics, but this one being one of the ones near the top.
Well, this is the top. Everybody who hears this piece of information, this story, has to know that this is not a series of mere statistics. This is a reality of a home where the breadwinner is out of work, of a family where they're making choices on the spot between medicine and milk. And this administration is delaying, frustrating, not doing their job. And it's not because of our good state employees who are compelled by their work to understand and deal with this. Because remember, a faulty telephone system or outdated software doesn't make it when we have a system that has existed since the mid-1930s, and we didn't have these problems when every single entry was done by hand, and people somehow got their benefits and got them in a timely fashion.
Yeah. You know, what do you say to the person who would say, you know, because originally I was looking at this story as, you know, back when it first broke, when they said, wow, we've got all these millions of people calling in and they can't handle the calls and the lines are busy. And my first thought was, well, I mean, could it be that you've laid off a good number of state workers and that you're understaffed and you've done this to yourself because we're pushing this austerity. We're pushing these massive cuts to government. You've seen across the country some 700,000 public sector workers gone off the payrolls and on the unemployment lines. There's a lot of people looking for these benefits and nobody on the other line. How much of it is that along with this ideology of our governor who believes that, you know, the unemployed are lazy and shiftless?
Well, I think that there's something to be said for what you point out. We have lost a lot of people in public employment generally, and a substantial number of them are people who are responsible for some aspects of the administration of our unemployment insurance system here in Pennsylvania. But remember, it's only been in the last relatively few years that people sign up for and register for benefits on the telephone and on the internet.
Right.
Until then, we showed up at our local Office of Employment Security and physically had to sign up for benefits and come in once a week to sign up for benefits and show that we were able to work and available for suitable work.
Which I'm in favor of going back to.
And I'm in favor of going back to it as well, but understand the reality of people not walking into the local office, not being interviewed, not being guided through forms by another person on the other side of a counter really makes this system much less labor intensive and therefore creates an ability not to handle fewer but to handle more claims. And
excellent.
The suggestion we have is that a relatively new invention with an even newer application to this particular process called a computer is somehow to blame. Well, computers don't think, Rick. Computers don't act. Computers are the product of information being input into them and put out from them. But it is people that are behind those computers. And when this administration is doing what they're doing now, having had the burden of the administration of this system eased dramatically because of electronic data processing, we can only conclude that this is an effort to victimize the victims under color of state law, under official conduct, official action by the Corbett administration to strip people who are already in trouble of that last shred of dignity by denying them access, timely access, to the funds to which they are entitled, the funds for which they paid unemployment insurance premiums every single day, every single hour that they worked. That's just not acceptable. And the notion that the Secretary of Labor and Industry or her spokesperson can try to lay off blame on the federal government to all of a sudden have an epiphany that suggests that the reason that this long-standing ongoing problem is because of some phantom cut of $30 million in a multi-billion dollar system is a cruel joke, that is not funny in the least.
Where do you see this going in the coming days and weeks?
Well, there are people like me who are looking very closely at this situation. There is a possible civil rights claim here. There is a possible situation where the government of the United States, Department of Labor, and or the Justice Department comes in. We're not sure yet, but there's more to happen on this, and I suspect that in the weeks to come, if I'm blessed to be on your show some more, we'll have more to say about this because this is literally just breaking, and it is, to me, one of those things that just turns my stomach because I've sat at kitchen tables of people who have lost their jobs because the plant closes or because of a layoff or because of the seasonality of their work or because the boss just ran away or because they adopted something like NAFTA and an electronics firm or a garment shop disappeared overnight. And I've sat at tables where parents had to tell their children, no, we can't get you the money to pay for a soda at a football game. We can't get you a new pair of sneakers to go back to school this year. We can't have a decent dinner. There's no McDonald's this month.
Sad.
And I know it, and I understand it, and I have wept at tables with my friends and my clients and my colleagues way too many times to find this particular sabotaging outrage to be acceptable in this day and age, because I know that when I was a child and my father had to be on unemployment compensation, long before there were computers, when telephones were party lines, when there were no digitized anythings, that somehow or another the benefits were paid, they were processed, the claims were handled, and it all happened on time.
Yep. No, I remember myself, you know, the times that I've needed it in the past, and I can't imagine without it. And I hope we're not moving towards a time, you know, when I see across the country there's a push. I know North Carolina just changed their laws on unemployment compensation, much like Florida. All of this push to take that away and to take that security away and that safety net that saved us from depression in 2008, that they're working to destroy those.
Well, they are, and you mentioned North Carolina. The U.S. Department of Labor has come down hard on North Carolina because of their insane changes as well. And in the state of Florida that you've also mentioned, they've basically amended their unemployment compensation law so that people who lose their jobs can't qualify for benefits, even though premiums have been paid on their behalf out of their wages that they should have earned.
It's infuriating. But as this goes on, we'd love to have you back and talk more about it as this story unfolds.
It's unfolding, and I'll be happy to be back to explain more. I'm not happy about the situation in the league, but I am happy to try to explain more, and I hope tonight I've had some chance to explain it in a way that is at least somewhat understandable. And, oh, by the way, look out. They're coming after us on workers' compensation yet again as well. And on that one, they're trying to make it impossible for the victims of workplace accidents, injuries, and diseases to get access to medical care. We'll talk about that one next time I'm on.
Yeah, I see they want to move it to 180 days from 90. And I remember when it was 14 days.
Well, it's not just moving it from 180 days to 90. They want to make it permanent that they control your access to drugs and durable medical equipment. And they want to make it impossible for doctors to comfortably treat their patients. These are the same people, of course, that complained about the Affordable Care Act and the government inserting itself in your doctor-patient relationship. But when it comes to people who got hurt on the job, they want to say that the doctor who treats you and whose treatment the insurance company approved and paid for is at risk that the insurance company might come back later and force them to reimburse the insurance company for something that they decide after the fact is not reasonable in the unique terms that the insurance industry itself says. And, oh, by the way, we're going to create a whole new industry for insurance, workers' comp insurance defense lawyers to make more money, even though Pennsylvania's cost of insurance defense lawyers is among the highest in the nation, even in the face of workers' compensation premiums having gone down an average of 4% a year for each of the last 2 years.
It's all about more. Erwin, it's always great talking with you. Next week, we will most certainly pick up the workers' comp story. Because as someone who has been injured on the job in the past, this is something near and dear to my heart, and I look forward to it.
More to come.
All right. Our good friend, attorney Erwin Aronson. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Besides being founders of our republic, what did Thomas Jefferson and George Washington have in common? Answer, hemp. America's founders were strong promoters of this extraordinarily useful agricultural crop, and both Jefferson and Washington grew it. The first draft of our Constitution was written on hemp paper, and as late as World War II, the government urgently pushed farmers to grow the crop as part of a Hemp for Victory program. So why are American farmers today prohibited from producing this patriotic, profitable, and pesticide-free plant? Political nuttiness. Most recently, in a frenzy of reefer madness, U.S. drug police decided that President Nixon's Controlled Substance Act of 1970 not only outlawed marijuana, but also its non-narcotic cousin, industrial hemp. If ignorance is bliss, they must have been ecstatic, yet their nuttiness remains the law of our land. The good news is that a wave of sanity is now wafting across America. In Colorado, for example, farmer Michael Bowman and Denver hemp advocate Linda Parker helped pass Amendment 64 in last fall's election. It legalizes personal pot use, which got all the media attention, but it also directs the legislature to set up a program for, quote, the cultivation, processing, and sale of industrial hemp. Bowman now hopes to be the first American farmer in generations to plant a legal crop of it, hoping to do so on April 30th, the 80th birthday of family farmer hero and hemp champion Willie Nelson. The red state of Kentucky is also on the move. Its Republican Ag Commissioner, backed by its Chamber of Commerce, is campaigning to legalize hemp farming there. And Kentucky Senator Rand Paul is co-sponsoring a national bill with Oregon Democrat Ron Wyden to take hemp off the controlled substance list. This is Jim Hightower saying, to help spread this seed, go to votehemp.com.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Earth, sky. Saturday, February 16th. Now is the time to become one of the very small percentage of people on Earth who have knowingly seen the planet Mercury.
Mercury is our solar system's innermost planet, so it always stays close to the sun in Earth's sky. Some people think Mercury is hard to see because it's faint, but that's not so. It's actually bright. It's just tough to spot because it's only seen near the sun's glare.
But around now is a great time to see Mercury. It reaches its greatest elongation, its greatest angular distance east of the sun, today. That means this elusive world can now be spotted low in the west as evening twilight ebbs into darkness.
Because Mercury is setting relatively long after sunset around now, you've got a good chance to catch this planet low in the west at nightfall. But look soon after sunset for Mercury. Even now, at its best, it follows the sun below the horizon by the time that it gets good and dark. At mid-northern latitudes, Mercury sets about 1.5 hours after the sun.
The northern hemisphere has the best view of this particular evening apparition of Mercury. The farther north you live, the later Mercury sets after sunset. But even from the southern hemisphere, you might glimpse Mercury to the right of the sunset in very early twilight.
So check it out. And for a chart, visit the Tonight page at earthsky.org. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science. We're at earthsky.org.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com, or give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So, last night during the State of the Union, the President goes, you know, hey, we need to raise the minimum wage. And all of the Republicans went, oh, no, no, not that again. I thought we killed that. We want, you know, like Michelle Bachmann, we should do away with it. Like, Ron Paul, do away with it. People desperate enough to work for 50 cents an hour. That's how we get them jobs. And I go back to the Carlisle Sentinel, my local rag of a newspaper, who in one of their editorials on January 1st, good way to start the new year. Just understand, the right wing, the business community understands that wages are really low right now. In fact, you go back to what I said at the opening, 121% of all new income gains from the Bush collapse until the end of 2011 went to the top 1%. What does that mean? Not only did they take all of the new income gains, they actually stole back what was already there that you would have earned. It's called redistribution of wealth. So on January 1st, the Sentinel decides, hey, you know, this is a good time to start the new year off right by quoting a Tea Party twit, State Representative Stephen Bloom, my representative, who's adamantly opposed to raising the minimum wage. In fact, he was quoted in their editorial saying, you know, from his perspective, increasing the minimum wage, well, what the government essentially does is reduce the number of people who can be hired. You know, the people without jobs who are collecting unemployment, you know, they can't get hired. And he says, you know, in these record times of unemployment, we can't have that. He says it sounds good and compassionate to raise wages, but the actual effect in the real world is that it'll prevent people the opportunity of getting a job, which is nonsense. Study after study has shown that view nonsense, but it is the right-wing Republican NFIB Chamber of Commerce talking point. They throw it out there ad nauseum. Oh, you know, if we have to raise that minimum wage, we just won't hire people. And you hear it time and time again, which is utter and complete nonsense. And they know it. But they pay editorial boards because, you know, they need advertising. These editorial boards, you know, they toe the company line. Because what they said is, well, job creation is more important than consumer spending or addressing income inequality. The Carlisle Sentinel editorial board says, in this economy, jobs are everything. And I go, okay, well, if jobs are everything, what happens if nobody has any money? What happens if those jobs don't pay enough that you can, oh, I don't know, survive on? What then happens? Will you be able to buy products that people with jobs have? No. But, you know, never mind all of the other states around the country who have raised the minimum wage a bit. Never mind the numerous studies out there that show, you know, it's going to help bring women and children out of poverty. Never mind the fact that two-thirds of wage earners in this country are women. Never mind that. Never mind that, you know, for women, they make 77 cents for every dollar a man makes. Never mind the fact that the minimum wage increase would help them. Never mind. Never mind. Don't look behind the curtain. Because then they're going to throw out, well, you know, the only people who make minimum wage are teenagers. I was at the local fast food restaurant today. There was not one teenager behind the counter. Not one. In fact, when I looked behind the counter, they looked a lot like me. People in their 40s, people in their 50s. Not one teenager. And in fact, the last several times I've gone through the fast food line, I have yet to find a teenager. Because if you look at the unemployment statistics for teenagers, the 16 to 18 range, the ones who are getting the minimum wage, they're the unemployed. And it's not because the minimum wage is so high. It's because mom and dad are fighting for jobs because we've got politicians who haven't been pursuing job creation policy. What we've been fighting over is created crisis. Because we create one crisis after another. The debt ceiling, the fiscal cliff, the mirage, now the sequester, and they always have such great marketable names. I mean, the post office, another created crisis. Another created crisis that's going to cost us jobs. And good paying jobs as well. This whole idea, wow, you know, and all of the money that's gone into pushing this message that, well, if we just did away with Saturday delivery, it wouldn't matter. You know, the people don't care. People care. People in my neighborhood care. My grandmother cares. And you know who cares? The tens of thousands of people who would lose their jobs and the communities that they spend their income in. Those people would care. And, you know, I go back to one of the things that the guy I interviewed last week at the Horsehead plant out in western Pennsylvania said about our governor, which is, you know, so observant and so spot on. He said, you know, the governor doesn't care about job retention. He only cares about job creation. So look at that Horsehead situation out there. They're losing 600 jobs to gain 225. So he let the 600 go. Big ribbon sellers, big ribbon cutting, big ceremony, huge balloons, all that stuff, because we created 225 jobs. Never mind the fact that it was a net negative. And as a state, we're going to actually lose revenue and lose GDP and lose employment. Never mind that. Don't look behind the curtain. Now, we still don't know what those jobs are going to pay. We know the ones that they're being lost, good-paying union jobs, much like the jobs at the post office. Are there problems? Do we need to modernize some things? Sure. Things they should be allowed to do that the folks who have created this recent crisis won't allow them to do. And I find it quite ironic that last year the House of Representatives voted over 60 times to rename post offices, but not once to figure out how to make sure that those 60 post offices stay open. I think there's a serious disconnect here. And when you look at this talk about, and it's coming, we're going to hear a lot of rhetoric about minimum wage, and the number one's going to be, it's going to cost us jobs. And yet we've yet to find a study where that's been true. In fact, I can point to studies where raising the minimum wage actually increased employment. Because the common sense is the more money that single mother has in her pocket, the more money she's going to spend at the local grocery store or the local pharmacy. Or, oh, hey, by the way, maybe take the kid to the playground or to a movie or for an ice cream. Maybe, just a thought. And that's how you build and grow an economy. Not by starving people, not by cut, gut, and punish, not by slash and burn, but by actually investing just a little. And, oh, by the way, allowing workers to share just a little bit in the wealth that they themselves create, which I applaud the president for bringing up minimum wage, but I would have much rather heard something about a livable wage. I would have much rather heard something about we need people to collectively bargain and enjoy some of those record profits, as he pointed out, skyrocketing profits, especially at a time when tax rates are so low. Going to take a quick break. Right back with hour two of the program. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. I'm the talk.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Sister Simone Campbell is not a nun on the bus anymore, but she's still crisscrossing the country as director of Network, advocating social and economic justice for workers and the poor.
Catholic social teaching is at the heart of it is about a sense of fairness, a sense of justice, that workers who work full-time should make enough to support their families. And actually, Catholic social teaching all got started with the idea that workers had a right to organize, that because we're made in the, as our faith teaches us, in the image of God and have inherent dignity, then we're called to use that dignity for the benefit of all. And that means coming together and making sure that working conditions are just and fair, that wages are just, that people don't struggle at the margins and be unable to care for their family.
Sister Simone is focused these days on helping to make sure Medicaid gets expanded to cover poor people as intended under the Affordable Care Act, and she also continues to push against austerity budget philosophies like Paul Ryan's House budget.
We continue to push back against the concepts that were contained in the House Ryan budget and the idea that cutting social safety net programs is the way forward for our nation. Clearly, reasonable revenue raising our taxes is a key piece, and making all programs as responsible as social service programs, including the Pentagon, is a way forward.
The Michigan AFL-CIO, Change to Win, and the Building and Construction Trades Council of the AFL-CIO have sued the state of Michigan in an effort to have the recently passed anti-union legislation known as Right to Work thrown out. The suit seeks a permanent injunction declaring right to work illegal in Michigan. Among the grounds the suit cites for abolishing the law is that it violates the U.S. Constitution's Supremacy Clause, because it violates the federal National Labor Relations Act protections on worker rights to organize and collectively bargain. The Michigan anti-union law is scheduled to take effect on or about March 27th. The lawsuit challenging the law was filed in federal court for the Eastern District of Michigan. In a new report, the Public Interest Research Group says states lose nearly $40 billion a year in tax revenue because corporations and wealthy individuals are using offshore tax havens to avoid paying their statutory tax rates. This offshoring of tax obligations also means the federal government loses roughly $150 billion a year in tax revenue. The Public Interest Research Group report says tax obligation offshoring hurts states and is unfair because it means that ultimately other taxpayers pick up the tab or have to suffer cuts in public services so the wealthy can avoid paying their statutory tax rates. This newscast is made possible in part through underwriting support from the IBEW and the OPEIU. You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. And I guess the question is are people more grateful for jobs that are created or ones that are retained? You know, you think about all of the money we spend on beating each other up statewide, all of this beggar-thy-neighbor economic development. And I guess that's a question I should have asked the guy who I thought was a great line, that our governor is more interested in creating jobs than retaining them, even if it is a net loss. So I guess the question becomes is, you know, which plays better in public, the ones that are created or the ones that are saved? Because especially you go back to the Recovery Act, where the president put a bunch of money into propping up the economy so it didn't continue to collapse. Those people whose jobs were saved because of that, I wonder if they're as happy as people whose jobs were created. Just a thought. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. So, you know, I look at this situation with the post office, and again, another, in my estimation, created crisis. Just as quickly as we created it, I think we can uncreate it. But here to talk a little bit about the situation is Jeanette Dwyer. She is the president of the National Rural Letter Carriers Association. She testified today in front of the state, the Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee. Jeanette, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you for having me.
So I look at this thing first. Am I wrong in assuming that as easily as they created this situation, it can be uncreated?
Absolutely. Congress created the mess, and Congress can fix it.
So what's the rationale for not? I mean, as I pointed out in the last hour, Congress was more than happy to rename 60 post offices, and I got to wonder how many of them were Ronald Reagan post offices, but nothing to help make sure that those post offices remain open.
Well, and with all due respect, the Postal Service, if in fact Congress will go back and correct the issue with a 2006 PAEA mandate, where we are mandated to prepay benefits, health benefits, and no other agency, no other government agency, no other private agency is required to do that. Without that $5.5 billion payment per year, the Postal Service would be not making a lot of money, but certainly better off in these economic times.
Well, I got to be honest with you, Jeanette. I don't want it to make a lot of money. I want it to make enough money to provide me the service and invest in its business, in its operation to provide what I believe is not a for-profit entity, but something that is good for the nation, part of the commons, something that we all do for ourselves so that we can get communications back and forth. We can get packages and parcels delivered. I don't see where this is should be a profit thing.
It should not be. We have universal service. It is a part of America, has been a part of America since the 1800s. It unites America, and people depend on the Postal Service. We are the most trusted agency, the most trusted government agency. That says a lot in today's environment.
How much of this do you think is purely ideological, the destruction of the Postal Service so that we can privatize it and profitize it so that, the handfuls can make more off of the rest of us?
It has to be an attempt to privatize because there's no rationale whatsoever for saying that you can make $2 billion by cutting out a day of delivery. What you will do is destroy the United States Postal Service because what will happen, those people who have to find another source for something they want delivered on Saturday, they will then go the rest of the week to that same source.
Right.
What will happen eventually is the Postal Service will become privatized because you're not going to have enough business. It's a service-oriented industry, and we only have service to offer, and that's what we're now saying we're not going to do.
See, but as you've laid out, I think there is another opportunity that Republicans, and I'm going to lay this on the feet of the Republicans. I know you're not a partisan group. I know you're not on either side of the aisle or not, but I blame this squarely on the Republicans, especially during the Bush years. And I think there's a good opportunity to use the Bush banner, the mission accomplished, pull that out of storage, dust it off, maybe get the sock for the trousers, and bang, you've got yourself another photo op.
We have to still go back and look at the $2 billion he's talking about saving. If you examine what he said, $2 billion, he said we're now going to deliver parcels, though, on Saturday.
Now, that's interesting to me. I mean, I guess it shows the real intention. I mean, we're going to continue to do the work of FedEx and the others, but our work, not so important.
Well, I think it's kind of a misnomer because if you look at it with a common sense approach, he said you're still going to bring the parcels to the post office. The mail will still be brought to the post office, just not sent out for delivery. Now, if you examine that in a financial aspect, then transportation is where he's talking about his savings. But where is that? Because
right.
Now the mail has to come from the plant to the post office and sit there until Monday or Tuesday, but parcels are going to be driven out on the route. So where is the savings?
Doesn't sound like any. I mean, you still got people running around. So then can I assume from that then the job losses? Because one of my big concerns is the job losses. So then are they telling us there won't be as many job losses or any if the same people are still going out delivering the parcels?
Well, I don't know where he's getting that from because he said 22,500 jobs would be lost. That is not, cannot be a correct number. And let me explain that. Our craft, we have 38% part-time people who receive no benefits. They work on Saturday or they work when a carrier wants a day off. These are people who it's a good middle-class part-time job. There will be no positions for those people should Saturday delivery go away. So that means about half of our 38%, which is about 20,000 people just in our craft. In the city craft, Saturday delivery would be somewhere around 22,000 jobs. You're talking about a tremendous amount of jobs in communities that cannot afford to lose those jobs.
Yeah, and I go back to what a guest I had last week said, you know, about our governor, that he's more into creation than retention. And, you know, here's a perfect example of that, that no one seems to be all that concerned about. The number that I saw was 80,000 potentially lost because of Saturday delivery. And you've come in a number about 45,000, just in the two things that you've talked about. So I look at this and I go, you know, must not be all that interested in retaining those jobs, especially those, you know, decent wage jobs.
And Chairman Issa, from the, committee today, he in fact said, you know, we've closed some post offices, some plants. He said, and, you know, losing jobs, we think it's a bad thing, but he insinuated, is it a bad thing?
Yeah, that's from one of the wealthiest guys in the country.
Well, yes, it is a bad thing. Losing jobs is a bad thing. And the bad thing about the Postal Service, and it would be middle-class jobs, decent middle-class jobs, and the sad part, those losses will affect mainly minorities, women, and veterans. Approximately 25% of the Postal Service employees served in the armed forces.
So let me ask you then, Jeanette, because, you know, there's a lot of money being spent and a lot of advertising and a lot of polling being done around this idea that, well, you know, Saturday delivery, that's, we could live without it. It's not something that's all that big of a deal. I mean, I saw another poll today that, a majority, whatever the number was, 51, 52%, they wouldn't mind it. What do you say to that? Because the message is it's not a big deal.
I think it depends on how you ask the question. And I think if you go to a customer and bring a parcel, they're going to say, where's my mail? Well, I didn't bring your mail because we don't deliver mail anymore on Saturday. They don't understand that until it doesn't until they just don't get their mail.
Exactly.
The question that is being put to people is the way it's being put. Would you rather your postage be a dollar, or would you rather do without Saturday delivery?
That's
Most
interesting.
People are going to say, well, if the postage is going to be a dollar for a stamp, then maybe we should do away with Saturday.
But is it going to be a dollar? I mean, what is it
now? No, but that's the way these things are being put forward. It's how you ask the question.
Right.
Do you want to keep your Saturday mail delivery? Is that all they're asking them? No. The Postal Service is losing money. We need to do this. We need to do this. What do you think we can do? It's the way you ask the question.
Because I asked some of I live in a fairly rural neighborhood, and I asked some of my friends who go, well, you know, it's not that big of a deal. And I said, well, what about next? Because what comes next is we raise the price, or we do away with universal service, which means you're going to have to go get your mail at a P.O. box somewhere, or they're going to deliver to your house only once a week because you don't really have the volume. Because as I understand it, and maybe you'll have a better answer than I do, that you have to, as part of the Postal Service's mandate, you have to deliver to every single address in the country, regardless if you're going to make money or lose money.
That is correct.
Now,
that's what universal service is. Universal service was created in the 1800s to tie America together. There are people who cannot afford. Fine, you can say, well, we're going to charge for Saturday delivery, a premium service. There are people who simply cannot afford that in today's environment. That is not what the Postal Service was created for. It was created for universal service to each and every American.
You know, that's an interesting frame. It was made to tie us together. And I look at what's going on, and boy, this just really for me, just this, it really signifies what some in this country are trying to do. The Postal Service tied us together. Now, by their actions, trying to rip us apart.
Well, and it goes back to the fact that the Postal Service is again the most trusted government agency. After 9/11, every day people knew their mail carrier was coming to that mailbox. It gives this country a sense of safety and security to know that their mail is going to be in the box.
Yeah. And you take no money from the federal government. This is no taxpayer dollars. Because I hear this all the time. Wow, they're losing money and it's going to cost me tax dollars. And you go, no, that's not accurate. Stop with the talking point.
No. We do not take taxpayer money, and in fact, we need to find out where the money that we're paying in for these pre-funded health benefits is.
That's another question. As I understand, though, this is the pension, correct?
It's yes,
75
it is.
Years of pension money, so that when my daughter, who's now 11, when she has children in a number of years down the road, they'll have pensions for her kids. So my grandkids will have pensions waiting for them if the post office isn't destroyed by them.
But why is the Postal Service the only agency? Why is the Postal Service the only agency, private or government, that has to do this? Why is that?
Well, because we need to destroy it. I mean, to me, that's what this is all about. All of this stuff is about how do we privatize not just the Postal Service. I mean, you look around the country, there is this push to privatize everything that is ours, everything that belongs to we the people. There's this well-concerted, well-funded attack on everything that is mine and yours and ours collectively, because there are some who believe everything should be done for a profit. And I just don't see it that way, especially when we're talking about our post office.
That is correct. And that's the way the American public sees it, our post office.
So what do we do, Jeanette? How do we stop this? What's the action? Is there any legislation in front of Congress right now? I know there was one last session that had more than enough votes to pass. Even in the Republican-led House, it would have gone through had it not been for the leadership in the House. Is there anything, and what can we do?
Yes. Bernie Sanders introduced a bill today. I do not have the full bill in front of me, but I know that a bill was introduced by Bernie Sanders from Vermont today. And Bernie has long been obviously he has a lot of rural delivery in his state. He has been a tremendous supporter of the Postal Service. And he continues to be, and I know that the bill he introduced today is to, in fact, save the Postal Service and to save six-day delivery and many of the plants in his area.
And, you know, I look at this, and it just makes perfect sense. It makes good sense, and I don't want to see our post office destroyed. I don't want to see it privatized. I don't want to see Saturday delivery go away, and I surely do not want to see the jobs go away, jobs that our nation so desperately needs at this time of recovering from our crisis. Jeanette, I appreciate the time. I hope folks will call their representatives, call their senators, write their letters to the editor, talk to their friends and neighbors, because this is too vital for us to lose.
It is, and I'd like to say one other thing. Mr. Donahoe, the Postmaster General, when he gave his speech saying that he was going to stop six-day delivery, he said that letter carriers were in agreement with that. And I told them today, that is entirely not true. Rural letter carriers are not in favor of this plan to do away with six-day delivery.
She didn't actually say that people were in favor of not having jobs on Saturday.
Well, he said that, let me read you what I read today, what I said today. The Postmaster General was dead wrong when he stood up at his press conference and said he has talked with letter carriers and they support the reduction to five-day delivery. I can assure you that rural letter carriers do not support the elimination of Saturday delivery.
Wow, absolutely amazing. Just amazing stuff. But like I said, we need to be calling our representatives early, call them off them, write them letters.
Absolutely.
Do all of those things. Jeanette, I appreciate the time. Great talking with you.
Thank you.
Jeanette Dwyer, president of the National Rural Letter Carriers Association, NRLCA.org, the website. We've got a link at therickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back with your thoughts, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Besides being founders of our republic, what did Thomas Jefferson and George Washington have in common? Answer, hemp. America's founders were strong promoters of this extraordinarily useful agricultural crop, and both Jefferson and Washington grew it. The first draft of our Constitution was written on hemp paper, and as late as World War II, the government urgently pushed farmers to grow the crop as part of a Hemp for Victory program. So why are American farmers today prohibited from producing this patriotic, profitable, and pesticide-free plant? Political nuttiness. Most recently, in a frenzy of reefer madness, U.S. drug police decided that President Nixon's Controlled Substance Act of 1970 not only outlawed marijuana, but also its non-narcotic cousin, industrial hemp. If ignorance is bliss, they must have been ecstatic, yet their nuttiness remains the law of our land. The good news is that a wave of sanity is now wafting across America. In Colorado, for example, farmer Michael Bowman and Denver hemp advocate Linda Parker helped pass Amendment 64 in last fall's election. It legalizes personal pot use, which got all the media attention, but it also directs the legislature to set up a program for, quote, the cultivation, processing, and sale of industrial hemp. Bowman now hopes to be the first American farmer in generations to plant a legal crop of it, hoping to do so on April 30th, the 80th birthday of family farmer hero and hemp champion Willie Nelson. The red state of Kentucky is also on the move. Its Republican Ag Commissioner, backed by its Chamber of Commerce, is campaigning to legalize hemp farming there. And Kentucky Senator Rand Paul is co-sponsoring a national bill with Oregon Democrat Ron Wyden to take hemp off the controlled substance list. This is Jim Hightower saying, to help spread this seed, go to votehemp.com.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
We don't pick up the phone, no more. We do it full of brick and pretty. Let's go for the lock.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Yeah, I think about that. You know, the whole mission accomplished banner. I wonder if they still have that somewhere in storage. You know, and of course the sock too. You know, if you remember the whole flight onto the aircraft carrier with Bush with the big mission accomplished. It just appeared. It was magic, you know, to use a Romney term. It just appeared like magic. And then you find out, you know, days after that the whole advance team had placed it perfectly. So the picture was there, and, you know, the whole sock in the pants thing, you know, that was there as well. Because you have to have your PR in place. You got to get your photo ops right. Got to get the right angle, make sure the sock's in the perfect spot, the sign's in the big spot. You know, and I wonder if all that stuff is ready for when they have their next mission accomplished moment. And I think, you know, the post office is another one of those opportunities for them. Because it's something they have wanted to destroy for so long. I mean, you go back to Reagan wanted to privatize the post office. Except they did some polling and found that, guess what? Nobody else wanted it. Literally nobody. And you think back 20, 30, 50 years ago, and you wonder what folks at those times would, what we're doing now, privatizing everything. It's mind-blowing. A couple of stories caught my eye the last couple of days. One today, the woman who, if you remember the story in 2009, the guy at Fort Hood, that Major Nidal Hassan, the psychologist, who were, I guess he was a psychiatrist, who opened fire and shot a bunch of people. Her, this woman, Munley, Kimberly Munley, and her partner were the ones who, I guess one of the first ones to confront this guy. She's credited with being the one who stopped it, because she, after being hit a couple of times, three times I believe it was, brought this Hassan down after she was wounded. And yesterday, after the State of the Union, there was talk, they questioned her about, what's going on. Evidently, her and the entire civilian police force on the base there at Fort Hood have been laid off. Budget cuts. So now, they talked to her about the State of the Union, and they talked to her, about what's going on. And evidently, according to her, President Obama has broken his promise to her that all of the victims of Fort Hood would be taken care, well taken care of. And now she's lost her job because of defense cuts and because of budget cuts and because of all of the austerity that's going on. Well, now they filed a lawsuit. Because lost their jobs. And they're not being well taken care of. And I look at this and I go, if these are the people that we call heroes, that we put up on a pedestal and say, these are the people to be, if this is what we do to them, cut them off. And, you can blame Obama if you want to. I think he had nothing to do with it. But it makes for a nice headline. It's how we deal with folks like her, how we deal with people like the guy who, there was just a story, an interview done by Esquire magazine. They interviewed the guy who was, quote unquote, the shooter, the one who took bin Laden out. And, he said, look, basically the military's given him the big finger. He did 16 years in the military, and when he left, they said, well, no health care for you. Sorry, you didn't make it to 20. Nothing for you. And he said that they could have gotten him a job driving a beer truck in Milwaukee, which, even at that, I doubt they could have done. And, these are the people that we've put up on this pedestal. Said, these are the heroes. What about the average everyday person who gets screwed in all of this? I look at what we're doing to the people, and I keep asking the question. I've asked it a number of times. What do you do when you need the next round of people, quote unquote, heroes, if this is what we do with them? Let's go to the phones. Got Bill in line one. How you doing tonight, Bill?
Good, Rick. How are you?
I'm good. What's on your mind?
Excellent. Listen, I just wanted to give you a brief bit of information I thought you'd find useful.
Hit me.
Regarding the mission accomplished.
Yes, hit.
And Bush's appendage there?
Yeah.
Technically, that's called a cod piece.
Right.
It refers to armor originally. But I think he got his idea from Howard Stern. So, from that movie he made that I will not name.
Yeah. No. The private parts. It is what it is.
Yeah, exactly. So, anyway, I think that's... that impressed me in a big way, too. I mean, it was...
And to me, I gotta be honest with you, Bill. It's all part of the image. It was all part of the PR, the photo.
It certainly is. It certainly is. And really, he should have been wearing it on his head if he was wearing it anywhere. But
are you saying our former president was a teabagger? Not nice. Not nice, Bill.
I had to share that with you, Rick.
I appreciate it. It was a good one. I appreciate it. No, but it all comes back down to this whole PR thing. I mean, it really does. I wish we had that kind of consciousness when it comes to taking care of folks, especially people like these two. But here again, I go back to what I said earlier. What about the rest of us? Because all of us deserve, and I use deserve, health care, retirement, security. Just a thought. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around.
after all, it was rock and roll.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, Sky. Saturday, February 16th. Now is the time to become one of the very small percentage of people on Earth who have knowingly seen the planet Mercury.
Mercury is our solar system's innermost planet, so it always stays close to the sun in Earth's sky. Some people think Mercury is hard to see because it's faint, but that's not so. It's actually bright. It's just tough to spot because it's only seen near the sun's glare.
But around now is a great time to see Mercury. It reaches its greatest elongation, its greatest angular distance east of the sun, today. That means this elusive world can now be spotted low in the west as evening twilight ebbs into darkness.
Because Mercury is setting relatively long after sunset around now, you've got a good chance to catch this planet low in the west at nightfall. But look soon after sunset for Mercury. Even now, at its best, it follows the sun below the horizon by the time that it gets good and dark. At mid-northern latitudes, Mercury sets about 1.5 hours after the sun.
The northern hemisphere has the best view of this particular evening apparition of Mercury. The farther north you live, the later Mercury sets after sunset. But even from the southern hemisphere, you might glimpse Mercury to the right of the sunset in very early twilight.
So check it out. And for a chart, visit the Tonight page at earthsky.org. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science. We're at earthsky.org.
Minimum wage! Yeah!
You know what it means when they pay you minimum wage? You know what they're trying to tell you? It's like, hey, if I could pay you less, I would.
Ah, oh, boy, that isn't true. Especially when you look at tipped employees. $2.13 an hour. That's the wage that we pay people who service our meals. $2.13 an hour. It's been, I can't tell you how many years since they've bestowed an increase on those folks. Today, though, two representatives, one from Connecticut, one from Maryland, reintroduced the Wages Act, originally put forth back in 2009, to raise those paltry, pathetic, meager, modest, whatever word you want to use for $2.13, pitiful wages up to $3.75 an hour in 3 months, and then $5 an hour after that, and then tie it to inflation of 70% of the minimum wage, which would happen after 2 years. I guess a step in the right direction, but a lot of crying. It's going to cost us server jobs. We won't have people bringing us our food for free anymore. And this whole thing over the minimum wage just drives me nuts. Here to get some answers, I've got our good friend Mark Price, labor economist with the Keystone Research Center, KeystoneResearch.org, the website. Mark, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, Rick. It's wonderful to be here.
So I keep seeing this frame that, and I keep hearing it from my representative, Stephen Bloom, who says, you know what, it may sound good, it may sound compassionate, but it's going to cost us jobs. And, you know, people won't have the opportunity to be exploited and work for pathetic wages.
That's certainly the position of the National Restaurants Association, but it's not, of course, what we know from years of looking at and studying what happens when you raise the minimum wage. Most of the actual research shows that actually you either have a no effect on employment or if somebody finds an effect, which is pretty rare, it's very small. So, that doesn't change the fact that the National Restaurants Association wants to make it very clear to you that this is the last thing they want to see in the world. But at the end of the day, it's not going to reduce employment in any industry, certainly not even in fast food and other food service industry.
But the thing is, the Restaurant Association, the worst thing that they want to see in the world are paid sick days for $2.13 an hour.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, they remain sort of the chief lobbyist arm against increasing the minimum wage in general and in most places. In fact, they were a big force in the effort to stop Pennsylvania from raising the minimum wage above what the federal minimum wage was a few years ago. They remain a big and important boogeyman on this issue, but one that funds a lot of misinformation and likes to pitch stories about minimum wage causing havoc and cats and dogs sleeping together. But again, most of the research shows pretty clearly that there are either no effects or if somebody finds one, they're very tiny.
So there aren't studies out there of millions of jobs being lost? Because the doomsday predictions I keep hearing is, man, it's the end. If we do this, employers are just going to shed people, and those poor people, they won't have jobs, and new people won't have jobs.
Yeah, no, even when they do find negative effects, and usually they're from a single economist named David Newmark.
We've narrowed it down to the one guy.
There is one guy who produces a lot of papers. Most often they're focused on other countries when he finds effects, but he's got a few papers in the U.S. focused on U.S. workers where he's tried to argue that he's identified some effects. But when he finds them, they're very small. In fact, they're substantially smaller than what the economics profession used to think. We used to argue, based largely on models, that there would be rather large impacts of minimum wage increases on employment, and lo and behold, even David can't find sort of the big smoking
gun. Because, it almost makes kind of sense. Well, if I have to pay more for employees, I may not hire one, of the 100 that I would to make up for the it sounds almost logical.
The other thing to keep in mind is that it may often be logical for one individual employer. What matters is what happens in the broader labor market. So you can tell stories that make a lot of sense for a single employer. They may find themselves at a disadvantage, but other employers don't, and so you don't see a negative effect. So maybe the better way to think about it is there are a lot of different avenues for a business to absorb an increase in the minimum wage. One of them certainly could be reduced profits. Another could be you get more out of your existing workers. They're more productive. Another avenue is you could raise prices. And of course, that other avenue is you lay off people or you don't hire as many people as you might expect. Those are all valid avenues for reacting to a minimum wage increase. But when you sum them all up in a broader economy, the end result is we don't see a reduction in employment.
Or maybe we could not have a CEO who makes a million times the hourly rate of their frontline worker.
Well, that's certainly one.
And I point to McDonald's. I mean, at McDonald's.
Right.
The 45-year-old woman who took my order this morning, because we keep hearing it's only these high school kids, it's all teenagers who make the minimum wage. That woman would have to work a million hours, to take home what the CEO made.
Yeah, no, I mean, and you've sort of identified another piece of the common arsenal of misinformation that gets thrown around out there. The people who earn minimum wage, they're just teenagers and wealthy families. We know, actually, looking at estimates of the number of people who would be impacted, roughly 80% of people who would be impacted by a better increase than what the president's proposed. The president's proposed an increase to $9 an hour. We have estimates based on an increase to $9.80 an hour, where 80% of the people affected are 20 or older. This is not a labor market that is mostly kids. There certainly are kids that work at minimum wage jobs, and there are employers that prefer to hire kids in certain occupations. But the broad effect of a minimum wage increase really falls on adults, often adults in families with kids. But again, it's a nice story to tell for someone like Representative Bloom to say, oh, well, you know, it's just a wealthy teenager getting this benefit. But the reality is we're talking about, you know, sometimes over $3,000 for somebody who's working full time. And frankly, you know, the other thing to keep in mind is that, low and middle wage workers today work a lot more hours than they did 20 years ago. And yet the minimum wage buys a lot fewer goods.
Well, I mean, the president brought up $9 an hour. Wasn't it just a year or two ago he said $9.50? And is $9 an hour enough? I mean, I look at Australia where the minimum wage in Australia is over $16 an hour.
Right. I mean, one of the difficult strategic choices you have to make is what's the level you're going to ask for. And clearly the president chose 9, which is below what Senator Harkin has suggested. It's below the 9.80. A lot of folks have been trying to pitch, you know, a minimum wage increase that gets us at least back to where minimum wage workers used to be in the 60s, and that's somewhere in the range of $10 an hour. You know, it's hard to know what the president's up to there. You know, certainly one common criticism of the president is that he tends to, you know, go halfway when meeting his opponents before he has to. And certainly this is one of those areas where maybe you would like to see a bigger increase than he suggested. But I think for the president to make it an issue, to make it a key plank, to push it, and to push indexing it, I think, you know, for whatever level you would like to see, it's certainly helpful to see a president pushing it.
I mean, when I see China saying that they're going to tie a minimum wage to 40% of the average income in the country, that tells me at least they're, as screwed up as it may be, they're trying to make some floor as well.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, one of the problems we all face, all countries across the world, developed and underdeveloped ones, China, Germany, is rising inequality, but it's rising more than anywhere else here in the United States. And it has a lot to do with, policies that basically have meant that the minimum wage doesn't keep up with inflation. It's not like we had a big debate about this. It's not like, you know, there was a big national debate. My goodness, we're paying people who earn the minimum wage too much. They shouldn't be getting higher increases. It's basically been a policy quietly over time to not raise the minimum wage and really drive a lot of people into poverty. And it ends up putting a lot of money not necessarily in the pockets of small business owners. It's typically the majority of people tend to be employed in very large corporations. You can think of companies like Walmart of the world. Think of the large franchisees in the fast food industry.
The Papa John's of the world.
Yeah, exactly. They're sort of benefiting from this policy. And like you said, it creates a lot of room to pay big salaries, fat salaries to CEOs. It also pays big returns to shareholders.
As a labor economist, have there been any studies done on what jobs are the minimum wage jobs? Because, you know, when I think of minimum wage workers, I think of the big box retailers or the big fast food chains. I don't necessarily think of the little mom and pop who's got two or three employees, because I tend to think of them as a little bit better employers because, hey, the guy who's running the business is right there. You don't want the people working with you starving right in front of you. At least that's my thought. Is there anything to back that up?
Yeah, the National Employment Law Project did an effort to look into the data on what we know about firm size, and they found the vast majority of employers tended to be larger employers, not small businesses as classically defined, that were paying minimum wage or slightly above. So small employers can be good and small employers can be bad. I'm sure you, everyone listening,
sure,
and you yourself have had experience with good employers and bad ones. But I think, you know, it's clearly a pattern, especially with very large employers. You can make a lot of money by paying people very little.
Look at Papa John's estate.
Yeah.
Perfect example.
Yeah.
Palatial estate with Olympic-sized swimming pools, golf courses, lovely statues, you know, and hey, good for him. But how did he make it? He made it off the backs of those people delivering the pizzas and making them who themselves most of the time can't afford it, is what it is that they make. You mentioned a second ago income inequality, and it popped into my head that the local rag of a newspaper that comes to my house every day, said recent, in fact, January 1st, that job creation was more important than consumer spending or addressing income inequality. They said in this economy, jobs are everything. And that, while that may be true, I don't know that minimum wage jobs are the ones that are going to dig us out or create a booming middle class or a booming economy.
No, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, in fact, what we have seen in some of the data is that a lot of the job creation has been in the sectors that tend to pay very low wages, right? And so it's certainly not the case that you know, everything will be hunky-dory if we get lots of job growth. We really need improvement in the quality of jobs. And there's only one way that's going to come about, Rick, and you know this better than I do. People need voice at work. People need to be able to form unions. They need to be able to get a contract once they do form a union and get it recognized.
Yep.
And those things are increasingly hard to do, and that's a key factor which is making job quality suck.
And our ability to demand some of the profits that we create harder. And I look at this study that just came out, and I don't know if you've seen it, but you know, for a while we were talking about this study by Emmanuel Saez and his partner. 93% of all new income gains went to the top 1%, 93% to the top 1%, 2009, 2010. They've updated that to include 2011. 121% of all new income gains went to the top 1%. So what I'm gathering from this, and you're the labor economist, is that people like me, we actually went backwards while they were going forward.
That's right. I mean, it's a stunning figure to think about. That the only in from the period from 2009, basically the beginning of the recovery, to 2011, only the incomes of the top 1% climbed over that time, beating inflation. The incomes of the bottom 99% actually declined, and that's how you get this funky result where the top 1% actually capture not just 100%, but 121% of all growth. It's
so if
really
I remember
remarkable.
Right, there was a Tea Party term for that. And it was one they used an awful lot, and they screamed about it. Began with an R. What was it? Oh yeah, redistribution of wealth. Heard that a lot. Now I've actually got a study and a statistic that shows redistribution of wealth. And guess what? We got screwed.
Yeah. No, there's lots of redistribution going on in the economy, and it's mostly up. And, you know, it's really remarkable when you hear people talk about it in ways that just don't make sense.
So when we talk about undoing some of that, and I do believe that raising the minimum wage to $9 or especially up to $10 would undo some of this 121% number, because, you know, the one thing that I think most people don't really consider is when you raise the minimum wage, everybody gets bumped up just a hair. So that's good for the entire economy because more workers have a little bit more in their pocket to be able to spend in the local economy. Yeah, that snowball thing we talk about.
Yeah, no, there is certainly a ripple from minimum wage increase. In particular, we tend to think, you know, folks within about a dollar of the minimum wage get a boost, but, you know, there may be some ripples that extend beyond that. But certainly it, you know, will benefit people even, you know, living within within a dollar of the minimum wage. And then, of course, you know, more spending. Basic macroeconomics here. Low-income workers, they don't save any money, partly because they can't. They spend most of their income on housing, transportation, if they're fortunate enough, health care. But basically their whole budget gets eaten up. So when they get a wage increase, it ends up going to, again, be spent. And that filters out of the economy. So there is actually that's why, you know, places like the Economic Policy Institute argue that minimum wage increases actually boost the economy. They boost spending and they boost growth. It's a small effect, but it's certainly one that's important and valuable.
Yeah. And nobody's talking about a $100 an hour increase in the minimum wage, right?
No.
I hear that obnoxious and obscene statement all the time, but no one's talking about $100 an hour.
No. It's another one of those obnoxious little ploys. All right. So why don't we pay everyone, you know, $1,000 an hour? Again, it's a modest increase, well within the range of what most economists advise that you can do without having negative employment impacts. You know, I think everyone would recognize if you raise the minimum wage to $20 an hour, $50 an hour, there are going to be some negative employment impacts from that, because that's will lead to a substantial increase in cost. But an increase within the range of $2 an hour, it's going to have a very small impact on the cost of doing business. And the end result, if you're talking about a fast food business, which is most likely impacted by a minimum wage increase, you're talking about a few cents on the cost of a hamburger or fries, which is really not a important effect if you think about the fact that you're talking about, for a worker working full-time, expanding their purchasing power by almost $3,000 a year.
Yeah, it makes sense to me. It also makes sense to me, and if we're going to talk about the minimum wage, we should be talking about a maximum wage, because I think it is absolutely ludicrous that someone is going to take what it would take the frontline worker 1 million hours to do in 1 year. That just blows my mind.
Right. No, we may differ a bit how we get there, but I absolutely agree that one of the things that clearly is going on in the U.S. economy now is there's a lot of money to be made by exploiting people. And that's one reason why you're seeing this rapid rise in inequality, because tax rates are very low, or another way to put it is we don't have a cap on what you can earn. And so all bets are off, and you have companies like the Walmarts of the world who can make tremendous amounts of money by basically exploiting people. And if we did things to make it so that you couldn't, pass on to your heirs more wealth than anyone else in the rest of the world, it certainly would go a long way towards loosening up and making it easier for workers to join unions, because you don't have to worry about companies being very aggressive about fighting unionization.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Mark, I appreciate the time. I appreciate the information. Would love to have you back.
Hey, thanks, Rick. Good to be here.
Our good friend Mark Price, labor economist, Keystone Research Center. KeystoneResearch.org, the website. Quick break. Right back after this.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/Visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/Visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS and Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Everything's raisin, but the weight is. Everything's raisin, but the weight is. Gasoline, groceries, and our hate is. Everything's raisin, but the weight is.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website. Or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone, take the program on the go. So I look at this study by the Economic Policy Institute, EPI, who says $9.80 an hour would lift the pay of something like 28 million people. It would increase the gross domestic product by more than $25 billion and could create the equivalent of more than 100,000 full-time jobs. And yet all I hear from the right is, no, because of some mythical idea. And it really is just a belief, because there's no documented proof. There's, as Mark pointed out, nothing. There's nothing there. There's no there. But it's what they believe. So, and I like the Economic Policy Institute because they do good economic research and they do good things in my view. So what does the right do? Well, they have their own EPI. Oh yes. It is the Employment Policy Institute. And they generally take the completely opposite view of anything rational. And I look at this whole movement to get folks paid sick leave, which I tend to want to believe should be the job of us together, collectively joining unions, bargaining for contracts, bargaining for better wages, hours, and conditions. But, you know, that's a whole nother discussion for a whole nother day. But EPI, Employment Policy Institute, funded by the big restaurateurs, you know, not your local corner diner, the big chains. Think wherever you go throughout the country, you see their names. Those are the people who are funding to make sure that their workers don't get minimum wage increases, to make sure that the tipped wage doesn't go from 213 to anything else, to make sure that there's no mandate for paid sick days or health care. In fact, we're seeing a lot of these chains saying, well, we're going to cut hours. We're going to cut hours down to 29. Why? So we can screw our employees. And for me, what we really need to be talking about as an entire nation, and really as a working class, is what conditions do we want on the job? What rules do employers play by? All of them across the board. What kind of an America do we want? Are we happy going towards desperation nation? Are we happy going towards minimum wage nation? I say no. Anyway, I'm going to take a quick break. Right back with Hour 3. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Sister Simone Campbell is not a nun on the bus anymore, but she's still crisscrossing the country as director of Network, advocating social and economic justice for workers and the poor.
Catholic social teaching is at the heart of it, is about a sense of fairness, a sense of justice, that workers who work full-time should make enough to support their families. And actually, Catholic social teaching all got started with the idea that workers had a right to organize, that because we're made in the as our faith teaches us, in the image of God and have inherent dignity, then we're called to use that dignity for the benefit of all. And that means coming together and making sure that working conditions are just and fair, that wages are just, that people don't struggle at the margins and be unable to care for their family.
Sister Simone is focused these days on helping to make sure Medicaid gets expanded to cover poor people as intended under the Affordable Care Act. And she also continues to push against austerity budget philosophies like Paul Ryan's House budget.
We continue to push back against the concepts that were contained in the House Ryan budget and the idea that cutting social safety net programs is the way forward for our nation. Clearly, reasonable revenue, raising our taxes is a key piece. And making all programs as responsible as social service programs, including the Pentagon, is a way forward.
The Michigan AFL-CIO, Change to Win, and the Building and Construction Trades Council of the AFL-CIO have sued the state of Michigan in an effort to have the recently passed anti-union legislation known as Right to Work thrown out. The suit seeks a permanent injunction declaring right to work illegal in Michigan. Among the grounds the suit cites for abolishing the law is that it violates the U.S. Constitution's Supremacy Clause because it violates the federal National Labor Relations Act protections on worker rights to organize and collectively bargain. The Michigan anti-union law is scheduled to take effect on or about March 27th. The lawsuit challenging the law was filed in federal court for the Eastern District of Michigan. In a new report, the Public Interest Research Group says states lose nearly $40 billion a year in tax revenue because corporations and wealthy individuals are using offshore tax havens to avoid paying their statutory tax rates. This offshoring of tax obligations also means the federal government loses roughly $150 billion a year in tax revenue. The Public Interest Research Group report says tax obligation offshoring hurts states and is unfair because it means that ultimately other taxpayers pick up the tab or have to suffer cuts in public services so the wealthy can avoid paying their statutory tax rates. This newscast is made possible in part through underwriting support from the IBEW and the OPEIU. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
As far as my 2008 compensation goes, it was for my work in 2008. I do believe that it was comparable to compensation for people in positions like mine in the industry.
Could you tell us how much money you made in 2008 before you got the bonus?
My base salary, I believe, was $350,000.
How do you get that kind of a gig? $350,000 a year plus nearly a million dollar bonus for a company that, well, took, what was it, $45 billion in bailout. And I found it interesting that Chuck Grassley, the Republican from Iowa, asked if it was morally acceptable for folks to take money from an insolvent company receiving federal aid. And you heard his answer. And, you know, I find it kind of interesting that the Republican asked that question, because you look at who they generally side with, and I guess it just goes to how ludicrous this whole kangaroo hearing is, and how, in my opinion, I don't think it matters. I don't matter which party it is, you're going to get a Wall Street guy there, you're going to get one of the insiders in there. I'm here to talk a little bit about Jack Lew and maybe a little bit about the hearing, but more importantly, the direction of that office is William K. Black, Associate Professor of Economics and Law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, also a former Executive Director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention. Professor Black, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you. Good to be back.
So I look at this, and, you know, my take on it is I find it a little bit disingenuous. I find it a little ludicrous that the Republicans are asking a wealthy guy who made a lot of money running a big company if he thought that was too much, when they're generally the ones who are on board with that.
Yeah, but, that's acceptable within politics, right? Both parties are going to ding the other side for doing it. But you have the fundamental point, and that is both parties have very substantial Wall Street wings to their party. Pretty much the Republican Party is Wall Street, but the Democratic Party has the Rubin wing.
Right.
And the Rubin wing is just completely dedicated to the interests of Wall Street, And it includes, of course, proteges of Reuben, like Geithner and like Jacob Lew, who will be Geithner's successor, and to despite this, you know, occasional tough question, of course, is going to sail through.
Yeah, I mean, to me, this is just a little dog and pony show to say, oh, look, we differ on something, but he's like the old guy. I mean, there's no change here. There's going to be really no change in policy from where I sit. Do you see anything different?
No, no. Indeed, it's precisely the opposite. The whole purpose of selecting Lew was to indicate continuity, that there was going to be nothing to change the smooth Geithner care and feeding of Wall Street. And you'll notice in the State of the Union address, there wasn't a single word about accountability for the elite banksters who caused the crisis. And we, of course, still have not a single one of the elite banksters in prison or even seriously investigated.
And to me, that's criminal. And we should be locking up the person who made the decision not to go after them. And the other part of this that infuriates me is, you know, we had this collapse of too big to fail banks, and then we pursued a policy to make too big to fail even bigger than too big to fail. And I look at this report by the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, who pointed out that the largest four banks in the country hold 93% of the nominal amount of derivative contracts in the country. The top four banks hold 93% of all this, and you go, too big to fail? Even bigger.
Yeah, whenever you hear about derivatives and how they're necessary for the system and such, that's what you have to keep in mind. This is really simply about the care and feeding of four banks. Count them. You don't even need all the fingers on one hand. Or at least you have to keep the thumb unused in all of this. But, you know, Geithner has been particularly bad. And so the inspector generals have done reports that have found that even when we had the authority to block the bonuses for people in the, you know, who got them because of the bailouts, that under Geithner they consistently refused to use that authority and overpaid the people. So it's really quite outrageous. We actually developed the term too big to prosecute as a form of ridicule.
Right.
And they embraced it.
Well, of course, because, you know, they have that kind of power. And for me, I mean, that's bad for, and I know this is not really a question, but it's bad for democracy. It's bad for our nation.
Yeah, it is bad for everything except the interests of a few thousand banksters who are not the top 1%, they're the top 1,000th of 1%. So you're right, it produces crony capitalism, so it is the most destructive element in harming our democracy. But it also, if you do like markets, it ruins markets. So some very conservative economists at NYU have written a book, Guaranteed to Fail, and they say when you get to be too big to fail, you create an implicit federal subsidy that is so large that nobody can compete effectively with you who is smaller. And indeed, their metaphor is it's like bringing a gun to a knife fight. And so they say there's nothing free about the markets. And again, these are very conservative economists, so they sound just like labor.
Yeah, I mean, with the big fish always eating the little fish.
Yeah, indeed, the big fish actually eat monstrously big fish, but not, you know, when you're a killer whale, your diet includes a lot of biggies as well. So. You know, there is no Bear Stearns. There is no Lehman Brothers. There is no independent Merrill Lynch. Too big to fail has always been a misnomer. It doesn't mean the institution won't fail. It means that we'll bail out the general creditors.
Right.
But even with that bailout, the looting that goes on by the officer corps through the compensation that you rightly derided and with Jacob Lew, means that even extraordinarily large and powerful corporations, even in the heart of finance with all their political power, can fail. And when they do, of course, they bring down the global economy. So the obvious thing that we ought to be doing is shrinking these entities so that there's no longer such a thing as too big to fail and too big to prosecute. No one should be above the law. If people are above the law, then not only do you destroy democracy, you destroy justice.
And you destroy the rule of law. And, you know, I look at this, and when I heard that question to Lou, I thought he would answer with, well, you know, you guys said that you need to keep the best people in place, and this was my number to stay here, because you hear that all the time. We need these, I mean, the Hostess, when Hostess went bankrupt and they shut down the plant, they went and they asked for huge amounts of money to keep the managerial staff, the top executives in place, you know, the people who ran the company into the ground. They kept them there because they were the best people, and you go, but you ruined the company. Why should we be paying you so much? Same scenario there, in my opinion.
Well, absolutely, and Jacob Lew is a classic example. Jacob Lew is a lawyer. He has no training in finance, and to the extent he's done things in finance, for example, running Office of Management and Budget, he's been a disaster. So he was one of the leading architects of financial deregulation and desupervision as well. Real enemy of unions in the public sector and such. And then he was a disaster at Citicorp, where the unit lost billions of dollars. And for that, they made him, for just a very brief time at Citicorp, impossibly wealthy, and he's fixed for the rest of his life. And, of course, after they make him Treasury Secretary, they'll make him even richer.
I mean, how do I fail upward like that? I mean, how is it that, you know, there's some people, I guess, you step in it and it's golden. I've never had that where I've failed and I've screwed things up and I became more prosperous.
Well, you're definitely asking the wrong guy. You know, we were successes, according to the experts, and my salary is half of what it was 20 years ago, so you shouldn't take advice from me about salary.
Wow. And the thing that bothers me is, it's, you know, this is another example of that swinging door. And as you pointed out, you know, he was made wildly wealthy on Wall Street. He's going to come in and oversee what made him wildly wealthy and make sure that it's there and safe and secure for other people to become equally as wealthy. And then once he's done, he will go back and become even more wealthy. And this swinging door just...
Yeah, it's just a revolving door, and these guys are in charge of oiling it.
Yeah, and the thing that gets me, again, you know, I'm a big fan of people joining unions, collective bargaining, sharing in the wealth that we create, and it doesn't matter. Party doesn't matter. When you put guys like this, or he could have been a Bush appointee for all I care, they're the same mold. More insane neoliberal trade policy, more monetary policy that makes sure that folks like him are well-heeled and the rest of us not so much. Again, I don't see the difference. So let me ask you, who would have been someone reasonable for that position? Or is it even not even worth the mental masturbation to think of?
It's not worth. There was no chance that it was going to be anyone good.
So there was never going to be a Joseph Stiglitz or a Krugman?
Even if
you consider them good?
Absolutely no chance. Nor someone like, say, Neil Barofsky. And such, who proved they're worth cutting down, you know, clamping down on the richest folks and taking on the governmental protectors and apologists for these folks. All of those people commit what the big law firm I started at referred to as CLGs, career-limiting gestures. They enforce the law. And again, Obama has continuously selected on the financial side people with track records of consistent failure because they're very useful. They will do whatever you want done, or in this case, whatever Wall Street wants done. And the fact that it will, you know, produce maybe on their watch, maybe shortly after their watch, the next disaster doesn't matter, because they'll walk away wealthy.
Let me ask you a last line of questioning I've gotten. It's on the trade side. You know, because it came up, Max Baucus said something about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, free trade agreement. How does free trade fit into to Lou's appointment? Because Lou said he supported both free trade and fair trade. Not that I think they should both be in the same sentence, because I don't think they're the same. But how does this fit into that?
Well, that was the clever political answer, obviously, and so he's in favor of everything. And you're right, the two are often inconsistent, and so he's told you nothing about his position. The general answer is the Obama administration is strongly in favor of what it calls free trade. But it has, in fact, brought more actions against our trading partners for unfair trade practices than the Bush administration. So are they the parties similar? Yes. On the issues near and dear to Wall Street's heart, assuming Wall Street has a heart, they're very, very similar. But it doesn't mean they're actually identical in their practice.
Right. Well, I mean, at some point, Obama still has to go look the labor folks in the eye and go, you know, we tried something. I mean, granted, we're going to sign the South Korean and the Colombian and the Panamanian, and we're going to push for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and we're going to for the Transatlantic, but we're going to try and enforce some things. So I guess to me, it's window dressing, but for others, you know, it may act like, you know, they're actually doing something.
No, there has never been a group that has done so much for a president and gotten so little in return.
Yeah,
as labor.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I'm still waiting for the labor law reform that we were promised.
Maybe hope you are very good at treading water.
No, not so much, and that's and neither are we as a working class. Because if you look at what's going on, a new study just out, 121% of all new pre-tax income since the end of the Great Collapse have gone to the top 1%. 121%.
In the State of the Union, again, President Obama said basically for 15 years, while productivity has increased dramatically, which should lead to wage increases, it has not. So it went instead to profit, and it went instead to simply sterile cash sitting, like over $100 billion sitting at Apple. And that, you know, okay, that tells you the system has completely broken down. And then he went on to say some things like, you know, the minimum wage, which is a good thing, but not going to happen. And the other things are just tiny. They cannot reform a system that has taken 15 years of productivity and said, we won't give it to the workers, we'll give it entirely to the richest people.
Yep. As I've been saying since 2008, there's a recovery going on. We're not sharing in it. Sad, sad stuff. Professor, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate the time. I'd love to have you come back again.
Thanks. Look forward to it.
Professor
care.
William Black, Associate Professor of Economics and Law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
90% of the world. When you fit in, take a look at yourself. 10% of the people. Own 90% of the world.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details.
Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555
or visit pseccu.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Besides being founders of our republic, what did Thomas Jefferson and George Washington have in common? Answer, hemp. America's founders were strong promoters of this extraordinarily useful agricultural crop, and both Jefferson and Washington grew it. The first draft of our Constitution was written on hemp paper, and as late as World War II, the government urgently pushed farmers to grow the crop as part of a Hemp for Victory program. So why are American farmers today prohibited from producing this patriotic, profitable, and pesticide-free plant? Political nuttiness. Most recently, in a frenzy of reefer madness, U.S. drug police decided that President Nixon's Controlled Substance Act of 1970 not only outlawed marijuana, but also its non-narcotic cousin, industrial hemp. If ignorance is bliss, they must have been ecstatic, yet their nuttiness remains the law of our land. The good news is that a wave of sanity is now wafting across America. In Colorado, for example, farmer Michael Bowman and Denver hemp advocate Linda Parker helped pass Amendment 64 in last fall's election. It legalizes personal pot use, which got all the media attention, but it also directs the legislature to set up a program for, quote, the cultivation, processing, and sale of industrial hemp. Bowman now hopes to be the first American farmer in generations to plant a legal crop of it, hoping to do so on April 30th, the 80th birthday of family farmer hero and hemp champion Willie Nelson. The red state of Kentucky is also on the move. Its Republican Ag Commissioner, backed by its Chamber of Commerce, is campaigning to legalize hemp farming there. And Kentucky Senator Rand Paul is co-sponsoring a national bill with Oregon Democrat Ron Wyden to take hemp off the controlled substance list. This is Jim Hightower saying, to help spread this seed, go to votehemp.com.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Neither of these things absolves us from blame. So speaking for the senior management team and myself, while we can't assure you that we won't make mistakes, we can assure you we're going to try not to. These were egregious mistakes. They were self-inflicted. We are accountable. And what happened violates our own standards and principles by how we want to operate the company. This is not how we want to run a business.
Maybe Jamie Dimon for Treasury Secretary. What do you think? They're a perfect failure. Why not? Come on, let's enlist him. Because I don't think it matters. I think interesting thought that Professor Black had. You know, I said, is there anybody? You know, can you think of somebody else? No, it's not even worth thinking about because it's not possible. Because I remember when before we were thinking, oh, who could he be put in there? Who might he name? And everyone, the folks on the left were, oh, what about this guy or this guy or, Krugman. I mean, his name keeps coming up. And there's no way in a cold day and anywhere that a Democrat would name Krugman. Because he's been right most of the time. Austerity doesn't work. This guy, another child of that mentality. And, on the worker part, not a friend to workers, not a friend to labor, in my view. Not at all. Randall sent me an email during the break, says, the late 1960s, the minimum wage adjusted for inflation was $10.50 an hour in today's dollars. So I think it was like $1.40 or $1.60 something back in the 60s, had buying power of $10.50 an hour today. And Randall points out, remember, if you are making the minimum wage, you are well on your way to falling into a bank trap. He says, can you say payday loan? And absolutely. Payday loan, all of these scams. What was the other one? I see Montel Williams on TV going, you can get $1,000 today. And you read the small print, it's like 90,000% interest. Or the one radio ad I heard riding home the other day from some, who knows, I think it's some Indian tribe has set up a bank where they're telling you, sure, you're going to pay a little bit more for our money, but, you know, it's not as much as you're paying those criminals at the payday. So I guess, you know, that's, you know, we'll cheat you, just not as bad as they will. And all because of the work that you do, you can't make a living on. Because you've got people like Jack Lew sitting in these positions who, they're not friendly to the working people. They're corporatists, man. They're Wall Streeters. And I think as Professor Black so aptly pointed out, you want to talk about nonpartisan? That's nonpartisan. It's not going to matter. Ah, it just drives me insane. Did you see the Watergate? Evidently, they're calling it Watergate. Last night after Obama's speech, Rubio gave his little I love this. They wrote the speech before the president gave his speech. So they were assuming what the president was going to say. You know, the government's, you know, he wants big government. And Obama said, well, we need smaller government. Pretty much had their line. We need smarter government, which, you know, is another key for we need smaller government. We need to work, do more with less. That whole nonsense thinking. But Rubio did his little thing. So he takes a drink of water. And everyone's like, well, you know, he's human, you know. I'm going, no, I don't think that at all. I think it was just a bad attempt at product placement. Little campaign cash. The other part that gets me is this whole push to privatize everything. To me, this is really, they should have put a disclaimer. You know, this rebuttal brought to you by privatized water. Because he didn't have a glass of water, he had a bottle of water. With the label out, you could see the label nicely. So you knew right then and there what you were getting into. And I guess that was the perfect thing. The perfect thing for him to do was to have that not a glass of city water, not that public water. We want private water. We want water that was basically out of a tap that we filtered through. And kind of like Aquafina is basically it's tap water that they ran through a charcoal filter. In fact, the guy who sold me my water treatment set up at my house, because we have well water, he said, no, this is the same one that, you know, that they use to make Aquafina. But they have it's a much bigger one, but they use the same thing. You could have Aquafina water in your house. I'm going, well, why do I want that? I really just wanted city water. I'd never had well water before. Seems rational to me. But here again, I look at this, and what it is to me is it's that whole push towards privatization, that whole push to take away what is ours. And, you know, even in the president's speech, he talked about public-private partnerships. And the whole scheme was really about the, you know, we need to get, I think, what did he call it? He called it the Fix It First program. You know, so we can put people back to work as soon as possible, repair our 70,000 structurally deficient bridges, you know, that stuff. He said, I'm proposing a partnership to rebuild America that attracts private capital to upgrade what our businesses need most. Modern ports to move our goods, modern pipelines to withstand a storm, modern schools worthy of children. To me, that line right there was the buzzword, the dog whistle, whatever, however you want to put it, to tell corporate America, to tell Wall Street, hey, we're in with you. We're in. The public-private partnerships, we're there. Public's going to take the risk. Private's going to profit from it nicely. It, to me, is that next step to fully privatizing everything. You know, going to get the roads, going to get the bridges, some railways, the power grids, public schools, you name it. They can figure it out. They're going to figure out a way to get into your pocket for everything. We're already privatizing the military, been doing that, got all those contractors. Just privatize everything and profitize. So when he says, you know, ask any CEO, or they'd rather to locate and hire. Do they want to go to a country with deteriorating roads and bridges? No, they don't. They want to go to a country where as he points out, Siemens America brought hundreds of jobs to North Carolina because we spent a boatload of money on their infrastructure. Our money. Privatizing for their good. And yet we keep hearing, well, you know, we're the most taxed country in the world. So get ready for it. It is bipartisan, and it is coming. Going to take a quick break. Right back with Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children. AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
John sent me an interesting story from WYMT Television there in Kentucky. Evidently, a pastor down in Kentucky was traveling back from Tennessee with his boxes full of venomous snakes, where they were going to do the whole snake handling thing. And John sent it because, you know, we had talked about the snake handling. Evidently, you know, the good pastor didn't have a license, and they confiscated his snakes, and he's not happy about it. Not happy at all, because now how are you going to do your snake handling without any venomous snakes? And like I said last time, the guy I knew who used to do it, they had the anti-venom right in the back. So what's the whole exercise? Anyway, he's all upset, not only about the snakes, but his beloved box. He wants his box back. He has been convicted in the past of doing the same thing, of having these venomous snakes without a permit. He claims he has one, but no one seems to be able to find it. So, well, yay. I am pro-snake, a firm believer, and this is how we thin the herd. Anyway, let's find out what's going on in Washington and around the world. I've got Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Ellen, what do you think, pro-snake or not so much?
Well, I'm actually going to be meeting an anaconda tomorrow.
Oh, well, better you than me.
I think I'll kiss it and send you a picture.
Yeah, you know, everybody has their things. I've always thought this was just a dumb practice, but then again, it's not really my faith. So, I'm very libertarian. If you want to go walking around with venomous snakes and jumping around, and that, God bless you, or whoever bless you, good luck.
Get this guy's snakes away.
Well, the police in Tennessee stopped him for a traffic violation, and evidently didn't have a license to have venomous snakes. So in Tennessee, and I'm quite shocked at this, that, you know, somewhere like Tennessee would have those kind of laws that you couldn't have venomous snakes. But even there in Tennessee, no No venomous snakes for you.
Amazing.
So what's going on in the big city?
Okay, well, it depends on who you talk to. Of course, we're still getting reaction from State of the Union. There is this whole deal that's going on about cybersecurity and the president's executive order, and then, of course, the debate about cybersecurity. So that's sort of hot on the hit parade. Then there is the issue of nominations of Mr. Cagle and what's happened with that, and Jack Lew. I think both of them are actually going to get through. The White House has been very sort of pushing on that.
On the Hagel and Lew thing, I mean, I don't even know why there's any push from the Republicans on this. They couldn't have gotten better guys, in my view. I mean, really.
Because they have nothing else to do.
I mean, come on already. We got much bigger problems. And look, I've got problems with both of those guys. But to be honest, that's probably what we're going to get. I mean, in Treasury, do you think you're not going to get anyone who isn't a Wall Street person, who isn't a Citibank or Goldman Sachs or one of those people? I don't think it's possible. I think both parties are in the same boat, in the same trough, and it's all going to be the same. I don't think it matters. I think this is all just a kangaroo show that, oh, look, all right, we're against that guy.
Well, yeah.
Sorry, sometimes I get a little frustrated because your thought on last night's speech, because a lot of my liberal friends very, very happy with the big speech. To me, it just sounded like it was a moderate Republican speech. I mean, what Obama said he was, 20 years ago, a moderate Republican. It sounded like that to me. This idea of more public-private partnerships, which to me is buzzword for privatization. Come on. I mean, curious, what were your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, look, it was not a lefty speech, although that is certainly how it's being painted. Although I have to, Rick, you know, I went to one of my stations in Tennessee, the Buckle of the Bible Belt. He said to me, if I were king, if I could make one wish, how would I change America? If there was one thing I could change. And this was 2 years ago, and I said, you know what? I would have education for kids from 0 to 4, because that's when neural pathways are formed.
Right.
And it was crucial to do that. And, you know, the teachers, like, gave me a standing ovation. And these were teachers from all grades. So here you have it. You have this group of people, and they, you know, they don't even want that. And that's just not even rocket science.
Yeah, and what I love is I've seen some of the studies coming out recently from the, you know, the people who want to bring us school choice, because they're all in favor of us having the choice of not being able to get into the schools that Obama and Emanuel and the wealth class put their kids into. But, you know, at least we have the choice not to. I guess that's the rationale. But there are people who are saying, well, you know, getting those kids into early education programs, that isn't really all that important. You know, because the studies are inconclusive, and I love that. It's the same tactic that they took with the climate. It's the same tactic they take with just about everything. Well, it's not really conclusive. Yeah, it is. You know, in fact, I've got 3 kids who went through it. All 3 of my kids read before they got to kindergarten. They were all ahead of all of their peers because they had the opportunities that their peers didn't. And I'm glad that the president put that into the speech, but at the end of it, who's going to do it? Are we going to privatize the whole thing? Is this going to be another, like the speech he gave about the school in Brooklyn where, hey, you know, we're partnering with corporations in education and you can go out and work for IBM?
Interesting. I mean, really, I got to tell you, you know, you and I thought the president's speech was sort of in the middle. And that's an example.
Yeah.
Anything he tried to do was moved in a different direction.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're going to be bipartisan. And to be honest, anytime I hear him saying bipartisan, I think Dick Cheney was right. Democrats cave. Because what was the first thing you heard come out of the Republicans' mouth? Socialist, communist. Paul Brown, the guy from Georgia, saying, I was taking pride in it. I was the first guy to call him a socialist. That speech last night, anything but socialist.
I did not see Rand Paul's speech. I did see Rubin's speech. I was just like, who can listen to this?
the faithful, the people who would handle the snakes, which is why I am pro-snake. So what were some of the responses you got from folks? I know you guys usually do go afterwards and hear the, you know, the each side give their spiel.
We got a lot. I mean, honestly, the Republicans were saying, well, you know, nothing new. This is, you know, vintage left winger. I mean, I was just in shock. He didn't do anything about saving the budget. Well, you know, the president purposely is not coming up with the budget till March. Usually it comes out in April. I mean, usually comes out in February. It's not coming out, at least because they want to make it not their rival.
Right.
They want to make it so that it is going to be something that people are, you know, that it's not, that it's a negotiable thing. And everybody's criticizing him for that.
You know, you look at this and you go, at some point, is it possible for them to put the political labels away? And I guess it's probably not, because, you know, I look at myself and you know, maybe what angered me last night about the speech was that he did try to, again and again, this being, you know, the umpteenth time, to reach across the aisle only to be rebuffed and I think compromising on a lot of things. I mean, you know, the call for a minimum wage, I was happy about that. I wish it would have been a little bit higher. Maybe, you know, let's start looking at what Australia and some other countries do. I wish there would have been some more talk about collective bargaining, something, the jobs that we're going to create. Can we at least make a living at them? I'm sorry. $9 an hour, even if you got minimum wage to $9 an hour today, I still don't know how you live on $9 an hour in this country.
Well, yes. And, you know, it was pointed out that President Obama in 2008 said that he wanted a $9.50 an hour wage. Well, okay, $9.50 was probably good before the crash. You still can't live on that, but it's a whole lot better than where we are today.
Yeah. But, you know, and lastly on the big speech, the big news from some of my other friends was Michelle Obama wore Jason Wu, whoever the hell he is, and she did it again. So there you go. Maybe you know Jason Wu. I don't know. I don't know who or what he is, but you know, or what it is that she wore of his. But there you go. A fashionista, I am not.
Well, I mean, they always comment or dress on her bangs. But don't forget, I was around during Hillary Clinton's time, and if she wore a headband just to make her hair, you know, easier to handle that day, they made a huge deal of it. Who cares?
Yeah, but do you think Hillary had the facelift like they think on Fox News? Big news at Fake News at Fox not too long ago. Did she have the facelift?
Well, if she had a facelift, I don't think she had it while she was Secretary of State. She might have it now.
Yeah.
But I doubt whether she had it while she was Secretary of State.
Yeah, I got
that
news.
That thing takes 3 or 4 weeks to take at stake. You know, whatever. She would never do it while she was still Secretary.
Yeah, again,
maybe
to
now.
Me, not news. Not news at all. But a bottle of water. Did you see the whole water thing with
right.
Rubio? The Rubio bottle of water thing? Personally,
I think
everybody's
that.
Got it wrong. I think that was product placement and campaign money.
Ha!
I mean, everything.
I love you, Rick Smith.
Everything we do, product placement. It's all about the corporations.
Oh,
go.
My gosh. I think that's hilarious.
And more privatization, more water privatization. You know, got to understand, you know, Poland Springs, they're struggling. They're behind the big boys. They're behind the Nestle. They're behind the Coke. They've got to catch up. They need that endorsement. So there you go. North Korea, how's their economy doing?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I think that there are a lot of groups that do the same thing at the United Arab Emirates, which is that, you know, no, we're friends of America, and then they do business with Iran. I think the same kind of thing is going on. Their GDP grew 0.08%, whatever, a little less than 1%. And they also have had an increase in trade, about $2 billion last year. And where's that trade coming from? It's
China.
Not all China.
Well, it's probably
not all China.
And look, you know, at the end of the day, we're a nation of, we've done this to the globe. We're a nation of capitalists. To where we can get the cheapest labor. And by tearing down borders, we're and I wonder, I guess another question, since you brought that up, then I wonder how much of this is the Korean, the South Korean trade agreement. Because there was a portion of that trade that they weren't quite sure. Could they get, and I, this is one of the questions I had when they were talking about the Corus, trade agreement. Will we be getting products, especially in the auto industry, coming from North Korea? Because there was a little opening there where, if you use China as the wild card, it could have been North Korean stuff.
Well, that's right. And I don't think, A, we're being told the truth about North Korea, and it's a grave concern, I think.
Yeah, well, they're trying to build a nuke. And you know, like I like the Andy Borowitz thing. You know, it's kind of like having a gun. We're all much safer when we all have a gun, since like the NRA says. Maybe we all need to have a nuke, and we can all sleep better at night when everybody has a nuclear weapon, right?
Right. Yes, everybody needs a nuclear weapon. Well, you know, the Second Amendment says we have a right to arms. What does that consist of?
A nuclear weapon. See, so we should be able to have them. Stealth bombers, the whole nine yards. The only problem is I don't make enough to buy a stealth bomber. And oh, I don't really have anywhere
maybe to... Maybe we could go in together on it.
And I don't have anywhere to land it. And then you have to wash it and put fuel in it. It seems like a pretty big expense.
I'll just land it in your backyard.
Yeah, on the side of the hill. Yeah, you'll trip over to kids' toys. More information on the post office?
More information, I'm sorry, on what?
The post office, one of the notes.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, they owe $11 billion because they're being made to pay ahead for...
75 years into the future.
Nobody else is doing that. But they are about ready to hit their $15 billion debt limit. What they really need is money to get their infrastructure together so they can save money. But the government isn't willing to help them on that.
Well, what they really need is they need someone to oust Daryl Issa. What they really need is Congress to get pull their heads out of their pucker and say, hey, we're going to undo the poison pill that we did back in 2006 by this insane mandate on you to prepay your pension obligation 75 years into the future and do it here in the next 10 years. That would solve the vast majority of the problems. Because had they not had that massive pension obligation that, as you pointed out, nobody else in any industry or any government has ever had to do, they would have made money last year and we wouldn't be talking about this. Here again, what we're going through is another Republican Party created crisis. And as easily as we created this crisis, guess what? We can uncreate it.
Well, yes, and that's both a promise and a problem.
So the GAO had a new report out on the post office?
Well, the GAO, they're saying, yes, we are going to be losing jobs with this post office issue, et cetera. But, again, they're basically saying, look, if we don't modernize it, it's going to continue to bleed money. And they're actually suggesting, in addition to saying, hey, look, you know, that's not the efficiency it's rerunning, they need to modernize the trucks that they use, all of that kind of infrastructure, the same way the United States needs to modernize its infrastructure if we're going to, 70% of bridges or something? What
70,000 bridges across the nation, structurally deficient.
Okay, right. So it wasn't 70%, it was 70,000. But it's that kind of thing, and if we don't modernize our infrastructure, we are going to lose jobs.
Yeah, and you know, it goes back to what the Republicans talk about, and there's where I agree with them. On a certain vein, you have to run government like a business, which means you have to invest in your government. I was just talking to a woman yesterday from the Pennsylvania Department of Treasury. And, you know, she was promoting the 529 program, here in the state, which I think is a great idea. Make sure there's a little money in there for your kids for college. But she was saying they wanted to do a webinar. And, you know, she called this company to try and set up, a link between their computer system and the computer system of the company that would host this webinar. And the way the guy on the line explained to her, he said that the computers that they would need are probably about 30 generations newer than what we have here in the Commonwealth. and that when they move into the 20th century, the company would be more than happy to help them host a webinar. Not into the 21st century, but into the 20th century. That's how far back our computers are going.
Wow.
But here again, it goes back to that very point you made about the post office. In some instance, we need to be upgrading. We need to be investing. But the problem is we've got people who they want to starve. They want to starve and drown it in the bathtub. And finally, right. RFK Jr., we got arrested over the Keystone XL pipeline. What did he do?
Right. And the XL pipeline people, the reason I think he chose today to get arrested, and you know, you sort of angle to get arrested in front of the White House, it is because he wanted very much to prove and to disprove the amount of money and energy that XL is spending lobbying in Washington this week, which is huge.
Yep, absolutely. Big, big, big money. Well, good for him. Good luck in prison. it is what it is. Alan, always great talking with you.
Thank you. You're so funny. I love talking to you. Thank you.
Looks aren't everything. Alan Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Thanks so much. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show. Changing America for the better.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky. Saturday, February 16th. Now is the time to become one of the very small percentage of people on Earth who have knowingly seen the planet Mercury.
Mercury is our solar system's innermost planet, so it always stays close to the sun in Earth's sky. Some people think Mercury is hard to see because it's faint, but that's not so. It's actually bright. It's just tough to spot because it's only seen near the sun's glare.
But around now is a great time to see Mercury. It reaches its greatest elongation, its greatest angular distance east of the sun, today. That means this elusive world can now be spotted low in the west as evening twilight ebbs into darkness.
Because Mercury is setting relatively long after sunset around now, you've got a good chance to catch this planet low in the west at nightfall. But look soon after sunset for Mercury. Even now, at its best, it follows the sun below the horizon by the time that it gets good and dark. At mid-northern latitudes, Mercury sets about 1.5 hours after the sun.
The northern hemisphere has the best view of this particular evening apparition of Mercury. The farther north you live, the later Mercury sets after sunset. But even from the southern hemisphere, you might glimpse Mercury to the right of the sunset in very early twilight.
So check it out. And for a chart, visit the Tonight page at earthsky.org. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science. We're at earthsky.org.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Let my daddy come on, he'll how it works when he come home from World War II. Now the yard's just scrap and rubble. Most of them big boys did what Hitler couldn't do. Yeah, these mills, they built the tanks and bombs that won this country's war. We sent our sons to Korea and Vietnam. Now we're wondering what they were dying for. Here in Youngstown, here in Youngstown.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Mary sent me an email during the break on the waterfront, pointing out that Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper, who is a Democrat, he testified in front of the Senate Committee on Energy and Natural Resources today. And, you know, doing the shilling of the oil and gas industry, the drillers, actually talked about a story that he sat around a table with other people in a ritual-like fashion. And I guess the ritual-like thing, the snakes. And this is the reason it popped into my head is I'm thinking about the snakes, and I'm thinking about, you know, okay, you've got crazy people who are picking up venomous snakes and poisonous snakes. They, God's will, you know, if it bites you. You got a crazy governor sitting around a table with people drinking, well, claims he drank a glass of fracking fluid because he wanted to illustrate just, you know, how far the advancements in safety have gone. Just sat around drinking frack fluid. He said that the fluid was given to him by Halliburton, and it was made of ingredients sourced from the food industry. So we're eating it anyway. You know, the stuff that they're pumping underground? Evidently, in Colorado, they have passed a law that says, you know, and Halliburton was, you know, one of the people there for his State of the State address last month, where I guess they passed a new state law that requires disclosure of the substances used in the fracking process. Now, some are saying, well, you know, hold on. It doesn't disclose everything because, as Hickenlooper pointed out, we don't want them to have to disclose too much because, well, they wouldn't come. You know, if we made them disclose everything, then they wouldn't come. And, you know, I think about this whole fracking process where, you know, you go, we're going to pump chemicals underground at high pressure, and these chemicals are meant to create cracks in rock, little explosions, and create these spaces underground. But it's perfectly good for us to drink. You know, it's bad on rocks. You know, but it's okay for your intestines. You know, it's kind of like, you know, a guy had told me, I had taken this hazmat course a couple years ago, and the guy said, you know, don't ever burn anything on the pans that have a nonstick coating and have birds around, because if you burn something, there's a chemical reaction and the bird will die. But it's perfectly fine for human beings because we're super beings. And he goes, you know, maybe a little won't kill you, but a little over a long period of time, well, think about the high cancer rates. So something to think about. Anyway, the next couple of days we're going to be taking a break. I've got sales things to be working at. You know, running a program like this, you know, costs money. And we've got to go out and raise revenue to continue for the rest of the year and on into the future, and as well as do some expansion. So for the next couple of days, we're going to be running best ofs to allow us to go out and get the resource to continue to bring the program to you each and every night and continue our operation. Apologize. It is what it is. It's the business of the business, because we do live in an advertiser-driven media structure. And, you know, as I say a lot of things here, not really big corporations, not really anxious to throw dollars at us. So we have to do a little bit more work than the average talk show. But we're willing to do that just for you, and we hope you'll understand. Again, you can email me any thoughts, any comments, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Forward to being back on Tuesday with War Stories from the Front. See you Tuesday.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the sway, imperial, mysterious, and amorous rain.